Hey everybody, welcome to the Chips and Tips podcast. I'm Tim Paul with Toolpath, and today's guest is a good friend of mine, Al Wutmo, from the CEO of Toolpath. Thanks for joining us, Al.
It's fun to be here, and even more fun to hear you say I'm a good friend.
Yeah. So here's how I like to kick this off, Al. I like to give my version of who Al is and give you a little intro. And I'll give you the opportunity to clean up anything I screw up. So when I think of Al, I think machinist turned teacher, turned software guy, and then most recently turned CEO, which is kind of crazy to think about with how long we've known each other. I think of Al as one of the OG HSM people. You're definitely the OG HSM person for me. Many people in the machine community see you as one of the first people that really drove the bringing CAM into Fusion. That's a huge accomplishment for the industry. I'll share real quickly. I know Al. Al was my HSM apps/salesperson, right? Going back to maybe 2011, we became business friends. Eventually, you're the one responsible for me selling my soul to the software industry. That's hyperbole for anyone who's taken that serious. But I was a machinist starting the machine shop for L3 Communications. We first met. I actually wasn't looking to buy HSM, but I was just looking for another quote to buy MasterCam. And I think you and I hit it off. The tool obviously spoke for itself, and then we've just kind of stayed connected from there. I'll share some more interesting, maybe some more interesting stuff about our past together later. But I'll give you a couple seconds to correct anything I screwed up, and then we'll get into some intro questions for you before we do a lightning round.
You know the thing I got to correct?
Mm-hmm.
I am a machinist by trade. I do have an interprovincial license in Ontario as a machinist. But I was looking through some of the questions you wanted to ask me. And I think it might have been less than 2 years of my career as actually standing in front of a machine machining parts. I worked in the shop for 5 years. But most of that, I was the SolidWorks guy running the 3D printer.
Back when 3D printers were not on everybody's desk.
You know, that was 3D printed in 2001.
No way. Yeah. That was amazing in 2001, wasn't it? 2001.
Yeah, the dates on the side of it. You shoved metal pegs into the side of a foam block and buried the print head into the foam block as the base.
Wow, that's awesome.
So yeah, that's the confession. I guess that's the probably thing. I'm known for being a machinist, but probably two of the, I don't want to say how many, 20 some years of my career.
Yeah. It flies fast when you're having fun, right? Let's get into just some basic icebreaker questions. What is your day-to-day life as the CEO of Toolpath like?
Pretty busy. day-to-day life. I tend to try and roll up my sleeves and be involved in the part of the challenge that I feel like I can be an individual contributor on and help remove those obstacles. So it's a bunch of that and then floating back up to communicate kind of at a higher level and pave the runway in front of the team. We're a startup, you know that. So there's this, you kind of think in 2 year funding windows. And so I'm worried about executing on what's going on right now and worrying about making sure that have the runway paved in front of the team.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like that's probably the easiest way I can describe what the manic nature of my life bouncing between those two things.
I'm definitely not here to make a podcast to fluff you up, Al, but I think you're doing a great job there. This is an interesting one I was thinking about. My neighbor, who's a logistics person for Intel, asked me, maybe it was yesterday morning, what the heck do you guys do anyways? Because he saw my LinkedIn, Toolpath or whatever. And that prompted this question. So, you know, when a machine, I mean, it's a two-part question. When a machine is asked you, what is Toolpath? What do you say? And the follow-up to that is when, you know, the person at your church or, you know, anybody that's not a machine is asked.
I think I'm going to flip it around and ask the anybody that's not a machinist question first.
Yeah.
Like, we make toolpaths, and that's a quick barometer to find it if they have any idea what I'm talking about or not.
Yeah.
Sometimes if they have no idea, I just keep walking or walking and go over to Carl's shop last week and somebody asked me and I told them that and they didn't know. So I kept walking. Justin, our CTO, got caught by the bait and ended up in a 20-minute conversation. But anyway, but usually I'll say we make toolpaths, and if they don't understand, then I'll explain it. Like, well, think of cutting your lawn. It's the path that the tool has to follow to remove all of the material, but actually there's another kernel that does that. What we're doing is selecting the tool to use and the geometry to use it for. And, so I think that's another kind of say, oh, cool. And sometimes I'll, it's kind of awkward, but sometimes I'll take the belt off that you made for me on the Matsura and show them the cutter marks on the back of it and say, that's the tool path. That's where it went.
That's awesome.
And it was somebody in our industry, it's sometimes a harder thing to describe because I feel embarrassing. We're using AI to make machinists more productive, but I kind of feel awkward around the AI element because AI is just one element of it. I gotta get better at that.
Yeah, you do. So this isn't an ask me question.
I usually just tell people, which is kind of the same way I sold HSMRs to you. Actually, I'm like, try to throw a part at it and see what you think.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to save that for later. Cause I think
that's usually my go-to is like, I shouldn't tell you about it. Just try it.
Yeah. I think, our HSM experience together is an important part of, probably your story and my story, but
yeah,
this isn't an Ask Tim question, podcast, well, come on. but what I said to my neighbor the other day, I was like, you know, CNC machines are right. And I know he's definitely lingered in my shop before. And he's like, yeah, I'm like, oh, we have a really cool AI engine that kind of helps people, you know, drive them around. And for machinists, it's pretty similar. Like, it's pretty cool. We help automate your toolpaths. You know, try it out. You should try it out. So, you and I chat a lot, so I know what you're obsessed with, the couple things you're obsessed with, but what are the couple toolpath things you're most obsessed with lately?
Right now, the thing I'm most obsessed with is how to effectively create the right awareness of what we're doing to let the industry see and let the industries kind of self-select if they're ready to commit time to doing this. Now in the startup world, and I don't want to go down too much of a rabbit hole, but I'm starting to learn this. I was a machinist, but I was a product guy for a long time. Wasn't on the business side. We've got this idea of customer acquisition cost and long-term value. And so what does it cost us to get somebody to try and buy our product? I'd like to spend as much of that money as I can helping a customer be successful. So the thing that I'm obsessing about is how do we get the customers we need while not spending all of that money on Google AdWords, but creating value for shops?
Yeah.
If we can figure out that formula, then I think we can do great things for the industry. If we're stuck in a world where we have to just pour money into traditional ad spend, then I think there's less positive we can create. Yeah. So that's what's kind of top of mind for me right now.
Awesome. Yeah. So I'll start at this point. I'll say that being a startup, it's been really interesting to see the agility of so many people at Toolpath. Luckily, I would say for the most part, our software engineers are staying, they don't have to be super agile. They have to just, you know, maybe they're being agile inside of what they're doing, but you know, the customer facing team, you, me, we've changed directions had to have a lot of hats, right? And since I broke my neck and back 7 months ago, we've kind of changed things up even more, where I kind of switched to being more product focused, and you've been, you know, kind of took over leading that team that I was responsible for with the customers. And it's been fun to watch. So I think it's been, we've had some good direction changes. Anybody looking to play with Toolpath, should check it out now. It's a good time to get in.
You're a far better machinist than I ever was. That's why you're now our chief machining officer. You were actually a machinist for more than 2 years. And I genuinely love bringing people together, which is more of a go-to-market motion. So I think it's worked out well.
Yeah. Yeah. It's working out good. Now's the lightning-ish round. Lightning-ish sounds funny, but I have a really hard time of letting it just be the lightning rounds. Actually, real quick, do you have any hard stop time-wise?
Nope.
Okay. So we'll keep it the lightning.
We can drag this on as long. I don't know if anybody's going to listen for as long as we talk.
We got to flirt with keeping it interesting enough for people to stay for the ride. So we'll keep this the lightning-ish round. You were on Dylan's. I call him out a lot, but our buddy Dylan at With Intolerance does a really good job with interviews. I appreciate how he kind of tells a lot of people's life story. I don't think he dug as much into like your chronological life story as some people, but I'm going to try to tease out some of like the themes of your life that got you to where you're at. But we'll start with a lightning round. So first machine you ever touched, CNC machine. No, like machining machine, not like a bandsaw or whatever. Mill, lathe, something like that.
Sounds weird. It was a lathe in 10th grade machine shop.
There's a lot of machinists that would say the exact same thing. Mine would have been a lathe in 9th grade. Yeah, machine shop, same thing.
That's true. It was 9th grade. The screwdriver was in 9th grade.
Yeah. Oh man, you're really wanting me to go down a history. So I also made a screwdriver in 9th grade. What I'll drop on everybody, and this is why the lightning round doesn't work for me, because I won't shut up. I dug into the history of how we learned how to be machinists, and so much of it came from building up for World War II, you know, teaching people how to make bombers and tanks and all that stuff. And a lot of those projects that apparently you and I learned, we haven't talked about this before, Al. The machinist jacks, screwdrivers, there's a whole series of projects that came from, I found the old, I'm still trying to find the actual hard manual, but, the old textbooks from the, World War II era teaching machinists. So screwdriver is one of those old projects.
Yeah.
So first part you're ever proud to make, hopefully a screwdriver.
I saw that question, and you know, the funny thing is the one that hit me was I just learned how to use the Prototrack CNC machine, and I had this part I had to machine that was a hex shape. Yeah. And I was so proud. I figured out, like, I told the Prototrack to do a bolt circle so I could find the endpoints to draw the hex.
Yeah.
And then I machined the hex. And my boss went by on his way for a smoke break, and I wanted to explain, like, how proud I was of myself to figure out how to make the machine do the hex. And he did one of these, like, follow me. And we walked to the material rack where he pointed out that it was almost money laundering, but we did lab setups for chemical engineering students and stuff. And they had to spend their money early. So he just always told them, you need 30 feet of hex bar, or you need 20 feet of hex bar. So we had like dozens of feet of brass hex bar, and he'd specifically designed this part to use up some of that brass hex bar.
That's funny.
I didn't use the brass hex bar.
Made That's a good one. That's a good one. Memorable moment where you felt like, you know, I could be good at this, or I am good at this, at machining specifically.
Memorable moment where I felt like
if you never felt good at it.
No, yeah, I did. I did another lab setup. It was on the Prototrack again, actually.
Yeah.
Big acrylic block with like 5-inch bored holes in it. And they were minus nothing plus half thou tolerance. And like acrylic moves around. And it was,
yeah.
It did the bore gauge with the kind of two little wheels on it. And working in three holes, it all had to be in that in that range. Yeah, I felt pretty good about pulling that part off.
That's awesome. Yeah. Maybe that's the same answer for my next question was, because when was the memorable moment of like, dang it, this is hard.
Oh, that's easy. I tell Kevin Lee that he's married because of me.
Oh,
I brought him to his knees. So we made models of buildings and bridges for wind studies.
Mm-hmm.
And so they'd have little 1/16 inch pressure tap holes all over the building so they could check pressures all over the building. And they wanted to calibrate the wind tunnel. So we did this NIST model, which was basically just like a basic house, but had 1,000 pressure taps across the roof of it.
Yeah.
And Kevin machined the whole model for a couple of days. And then he took Friday off. It was the Friday he ended up proposing to his wife.
Mm.
And I was left with the job of drilling the 16th inch holes in the top of it. And we were using Mastercam. It was just points on a surface. So I just windowed all the points to drill them all. That was super good. Probably should have simulated because there was a point at the origin. It was the bottom dead center of the model.
Mm.
So I was literally sitting on the table of the footall that didn't have a shroud, with a little brush in oil, 16th inch holes, pecking in acrylic. It did half of them and then punched a hole in the middle of it to go peck drill at the bottom center of the origin. So I brought Kevin Lee to his knees because that's when he was on his knees proposing to his wife and I was blowing apart his model that I just had to add a couple pressure tapped holes to.
That's awesome. Shout out to Kevin Lee.
He was a far better machinist.
He's
a far better machinist than me.
He's
I'm gonna go off on a tangent because he said we can.
Yeah.
We'd make models of bridges for the wind tunnel. So they'd be like 16-foot long bridges. And through the middle of it was an aluminum spine that would mimic the strength of the bridge. And then we would clad it with machined foam or 3D printed with brass weights to get the mass and inertia right of the bridge. And he would machine these aluminum spines that were like plus or minus half thou tolerance and 16 feet long.
Damn.
Each section being within a tolerance. He did it on an old VF2. Like it was, that was impressive. I made three holes the right size, like these 16 foot long aluminum spines.
You've told me about that, the wind tunnel work you've done, and it felt pretty abstract. I made satellite stuff. My daughter like, man, you know, satellite stuff. Carol and I went to the Hoover Dam, and I think I was talking to you. You were in Vegas for AU or whatever. We were coming back, and if I remember right, you were like, hey, that bridge that's right behind you. We simulated that in the wind tunnel. Yep. Is my memory right?
Yeah. So we made three styles of models,
mm-hmm.
a pressure model, an aeroelastic model, and then the full aerostatic model, where the pressure model is a rigid version of the building or bridge.
Okay.
And you would just like see in a hurricane, how much pressure is on this window? Is it going to get the window sucked out of the building or whatever?
Okay.
The balance model was just a foam model to see how much the building would sway. But the aerelastic models of the bridges were like literally this long spine. And then if you remember like 10th grade physics class where you had that thing that would send the sine wave along the building, if that makes sense. There was a Tacoma Narrows bridge that got going and broke.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. So we made the bridges where they understood the engineers understood the strength of it. So we'd mimic the strength, and then we would clad the bridge in like individual segments connected to that chunk of spine. So the whole bridge could move.
Yeah.
That's cool. And I mean, this is what I spent most of my career doing actually, is taking the architectural prints, creating a SolidWorks model of it, splitting it up, and then putting brass weights in the right spot in the bridge so that the strength, mass, and inertia were all right. So then they could put the bridge in the wind tunnel and see what it would do.
That's cool.
They build like the whole foam city around it, which is actually more complicated than wind studies for a car or something, because it's always coming straight at it. Whereas this, they have to see what the wind is going to do.
That's cool.
Anyway, maybe it's still abstract and a tangent.
I don't know. For me, anybody who's been to Hoover Dam, I think I had to drive over the bridge to get to there, whatever. And it just added like a one of those real moments, right?
The real moment for me was watching Mission Impossible. He climbed up Burj Dubai, because we did for the really tall buildings, we did that flexible version of the Burj Dubai. We made a full air elastic model of that.
That's cool. That's cool. Okay, so that's our early sparks kind of theme for the lightning round. We're going to move into what's your first your cam roots. So what's the first cam system you used?
Mastercam.
How many different cam systems have you used?
The only cam systems I used where I was actually paid to make parts was Mastercam and Camworks.
Oh, that's an interesting one. So you've been paid to use Mastercam and Camworks, you said?
Yes. Oops.
Okay. No, there's no oops about anything. Okay. So then on top of that, did you learn anything?
HSM Works, obviously. I sold it to you and used it. And then Fusion, obviously.
Inventor HSM. Was responsible
for the Dell Cam products. To be honest, I didn't use them much. We had a team that knew them far better than I ever did.
Yeah, yeah. Some people assume I knew the Dell Cam products. So I guess I used Feature Cam in industry, but I'd open a Power Mill a couple times and just like,
yeah, I'm not smart
enough. This needs some training. Okay. This is an interest. Well, it's an interesting one. I think is what like feature or workflow. I mean, you've seen some stuff in the cam industry. Is there a feature or workflow in cam side of things that you really feel like, you know, really changed was a game changer for the industry?
I think how easy the early HSM Works team made 3+2 programming was a game changer.
Yeah.
And then I hope it's true, but I think when we made it easy to drive your probe in Fusion, that was also a game changer. Those are the ones that I feel like I was a part of. Obviously, like I can wrap the tool around and make an impeller is interesting, but I don't think those are game changers in the niche markets. To me, the game changers are the pervasive things, but that's
those are some good ones. Pretty aligned with my opinions too. What I'll say about HSM Works, and the reason I bought it, was I was in the middle of starting the shop, and it was the first time I'd used a cam tool, and I was excited that I was going to be able to teach somebody this tool. Previously, I've taught, Mastercam and other tools to machinists, and it was kind of a dread to me. It was like, ugh, because I like, when I teach something, I like to be able to kind of teach things that make sense, not just like things you have to remember. So that was fun for me. Let's get into shop favorites. So favorite CNC machine you've ever run.
This is gonna sound so funny, but
it doesn't even have to be sexy.
It feels wrong for me saying this. The favorite machine I ran when I was in the shop was the Maxim Stratasys machine. I was the one that got the FDM 3000 going, and a regular part of our process, we went from machining parts to 3D printing most of the early models. So it made the business case to spend $250,000 on a big 3D printer.
That's cool.
So that was kind of like my machine in the shop for a while.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Is again weird because we started saying I'm a machinist and admitting how much time I actually spent as a CAD jockey and a 3D printing guy.
Yeah, no, I love it. When I was starting that L3 shop, I think I was telling you what I was starting with, and it was like three prototracks and a couple Brown and Sharps. And I said, as I was opening my mouth to say, I don't even know what a prototrack is. And I'm not knocking prototrack. It was just, I came from the world of big Mazaks and stuff like that. And I remember like, you're like, oh, I love prototracks. And I remember being like, tell me about them.
Yeah.
Cause I need to either love them or hate them.
Machine. Like I genuinely did love it. Like it was just a machine you just walk up to with an idea in your head and a part off of it 5 minutes later, turn the handles a little bit. And
yeah,
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. That conversation, I assume you don't even remember it. That conversation made me look at those differently. I was planning on taking a bulldozer and pushing everything out of the shop just so I had an empty box to start with. And I ended up giving one of those away to a friend, and then, which I kind of wish I had now. Oh,
I wish I was your friend then.
Yeah, exactly.
One.
And then we kept two of them.
I think it's important to have some tools that you can just like whip out and use on a moment's notice.
I
think that's a good example of one of those tools.
What we used them for most often, trying to remember if I'm right there, but yeah, we made space communication payloads. And every once in a while something didn't work right. And we had a hermetically sealed laser welded lid on something. And so FOD was an issue. So we would use these prototracks to de-lid things so the techs could go work on them. And it was pretty awesome because, you know, we could be right there. You know, I could actually take the handle and just walk it through the cut with my alcohol. It's the right tool for the right job, right?
We were both like, we were making the wind tunnel models that were definitely driven off of CAD, but that's a whole nother tangent of how incomplete the architectural prints were when we were building the models. But then the other thing was lab setups for engineering students, mostly chemical engineering students. And you'd build the whole thing and they'd bring it back and want a little modification. And it just, the time it would take to CAD it up in SolidWorks and then do everything, it was often easier just to walk it to the prototrack and machine it.
Yeah, it was nice. I have since seen an enclosed CNC machine that you could jog through the motion, and I can't remember what machine that was, but that was my favorite thing because
they do have that. I'm not as big a fan. The thing I loved about the one I ran is just the level of versatility. You can hang something off the side of it, you just walk up to it and just use it. That's what made it amazing to me.
Yeah. Same reason to love a Bridgeport, just better.
I'm not, but I'm also not a planner, so it was one of those machines that you just walk up to without a plan.
Yeah. Okay. Speaking of tools, do you have a favorite tool? Could be anything. Box knife, anything fancy, anything not fancy.
This is gonna be a weird one. A Makita PEX expander. I used to hate plumbing, and then I put in a water softener in our house. And I got that PEX expander. It's like plumbing is fun now.
Not so bad.
Yeah. I've lent that to a bunch of friends. I'm like, this is my favorite tool. You have to try it.
I wish you were closer. When I moved into this house, it was like 2 years old, and I had in another room over there. I came in, the drywall was sagging. And when they built the house, they nicked the PEX. And it leaked, and I ended up I had to go rent one, but I thought about buying one. All right, in machining, is there anything that's ever just kicked your butt? follow up to that, how did it end up?
Machining the things that kicked my butt. I think you're poking at finding out how short my time as a machinist actually was.
The thing that
kicked my butt. Yeah, this was actually fun. It was kicked my butt, and I was pretty proud of it too. So, the Putrajaya footbridge, we made a model of, and it was like this bridge that started narrow on one side and arced and got wider and went over to the other side.
Oh, interesting.
And so it had the aluminum spine through it. It had the foam cladding on it and then the brass weights in it. So I ended up doing the whole thing with configurations in SolidWorks because each section was its own configuration. But we had to kind of vary the size of the weight to get the mass and inertia right. I think I probably spent a month making that model and then making a fixturing process so that I could machine all the foam models. Cause usually on the bridges, they'd be 16 foot long with 2-inch sections. And it was like a whole lot of sections that were the same. In this case, the bridge was 16 feet long with 2-foot sections, but every single one of them
was
different, but kind of similar.
Yeah.
That one kicked. It also ended up when I was putting it together, I have a cut on my thumb because gluing it together at the end and slipped with an X-Acto knife and filleted my thumb open. Then I just grabbed the crazy glue, stuck it back together because we had to get the bridge done that night.
I had to keep working.
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay. That's great. Let's move into career snapshots. So I think maybe it's the way my brain works, but I can think through my life into like turning points. Like this happened, turned me this direction. Or big moments, right? Like I remember the second I was like, I'm gonna be a machinist. Do you have like some steps like that? Can you share them?
I can, yeah. So the first one I think is when I got into machining. Initially I was machining because I thought I wanted to be an engineer. And then I ended up like realizing I loved seeing and making parts and seeing what I did at the end of the day. And I thought, well, that'll make me a better engineer.
Yeah.
And then when I did the initial machining program, I got the apprenticeship as a machinist in the engineering building. So it was kind of like, that was like, okay, I'm committed to this now.
That's cool.
So that was the kind of first step as a machinist. And then, had a bit of a life change in the dating world. And I was praying about a change in career. Got to work that day and got a phone call from my old shop teacher that said we had to fire the drafting teacher, which incidentally was the only class in high school I ever dropped. And we can get you a letter of permission to come teach.
Wow.
Come talk to the principal tomorrow morning. I went and talked to the principal and she said, your math teacher and shop teacher are rooting for you. The job's yours if you want it. So that was like immediate about, I was the shy kid that didn't talk in front of people in school. And next thing I know it, I was teaching one math class, a machine shop class, a welding class. like it was just two weeks later. So that was a pretty dramatic change. And then, when I was getting, I thought I'd keep that job forever, just like I thought I'd keep the machining job at the university forever. And then I was getting married. We ended up deciding to move to California. So it was like an abrupt change from being a teacher. I actually didn't get into teacher's college, and there's a fun story there. So I ended up moving to California and starting a business to facilitate teachers teaching SolidWorks.
Yeah.
So that was a pretty dramatic change. And then I think the next dramatic change was, I was dropping my kid off to go on tall ships for the week. And I woke up to read on the forum that Autodesk had acquired HSM Works, which I had started to pivot towards that. The SolidWorks training I was doing was starting to get kind of static. Mm-hmm. And I was a machinist, so I went and found Cam and found HSM Works and like fell in love with HSM Works and started slowly transitioning my business to creating training content for HSM Works, using the training content to sell HSM Works. That's how we got to know each other.
Yeah.
So that was probably the softest of changes. Then I woke up and HSM Works sold to Autodesk. It's like, well, I guess I don't know what we're doing now. So my wife and I just took a 1 week vacation. Like I don't know what to do for the week. Let's wait and find out what happens. And ended up with a job as application engineer at Autodesk, and that led into product manager at Autodesk.
Yeah.
So again, kind of slow change over those 10 years. And then again, I told more of the story on the Making Chips podcast, but I tend to have come to learn the working genius and come to quite realize that with the working genius, it's this idea. If I'm going off on a tangent, cut me off. But
no, go.
The idea of working genius is widget. All work goes through six phases: wonder and invention. Then there's discernment and galvanizing, and then enablement and tenacity. And I kind of find it funny. My voice even falls off with enablement and tenacity. But the idea is like, I wonder why that is the way it is. And I was like, yes, and I'm going to invent a solution and then discern if it's a good idea. That's a good idea. Let's get people excited about it. And now let's enable them again. And now let's build the task list to finish it. And we need to have the tenacity to finish it. And the idea is everybody gets joy from two of those. Two of them drains them, and two of them is kind of in the middle.
Yeah.
I tend to love the invention phase of new things and the galvanizing and getting people excited about getting that going. And for what I was doing at Fusion, we'd kind of set the framework for how you connect CAD and CAM together.
Yeah.
There's a long tail of making it a full CAM system, but it was starting to drain and exhaust me. And I've been praying about it for a while. Like, what's the next change for me? I actually told my wife on the couch, like in the past, I've told you in the past, my prayers just have always been answered. The job change to teaching was like answered instantly. I'm like, I don't think this one's getting answered. I think I just have to get some tenacity.
Yeah.
And I walked out 15 minutes later to a phone call with Andy, just to any other phone call. And I made a side comment, kind of a meaningless, I'd bet my career on your approach. It was just sort of like my validation. And he instantly said, then come lead us. And I was like a pretty abrupt, like, okay, I just thought there wasn't going to be a change. And then that happened. So that's the most recent change. And at each time at each of the abrupt ones, it was tied to faith and prayer.
That's a good one. That's not a good one. That's a good series.
Guy who was a machinist for 2 years in Canada and should not be leading software companies in California that have been as disruptive as they are, it's got very little to do with me.
Yeah, I can say lots of reasons why I shouldn't be where I am and all that, but we're here for a reason, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so most important moment in your career so far? That's a hard one to nail down. Maybe.
I don't know. My career's not done yet, so
that's why it's always hard.
Yeah. I think I mentioned a bunch of the. I mentioned each of the pivotal moments.
Yeah, that's good. Hopefully, maybe the right answer is the last big one, right?
I think maybe I'd say the most important moments is that each part in my career I've had specific mentors that have helped me.
Yeah.
My career is now sort of, I think at this point it's safe to say my career is being established around leading software teams and manufacturing.
Yeah.
And I think probably the most important moment was in. Yeah, obviously it's the most important moment.
Yeah.
Carl Bass's minivan. Mm-hmm. We'd left Autodesk office. He was building his machine shop.
Yeah.
And instead of going out for dinners, I'd go hang out with him in his machine shop. And I was still the application engineer for for HSM works in CAM, and Anthony Graves is still the product manager. And he had just said that he was leaving Autodesk until they needed a product manager. And Carl White asked me if I'd do it. And so I kind of asked Carl, like, I don't know what I'm doing. Would you mentor me? And I'll mentor you in machining and you mentor me in software. And he said, yes. And he has. Yeah. I think it's been pretty important for at least the last 12 years.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's a good one.
Yeah.
I hate to crap on that with what's your biggest mistake you've made professionally. Or just a good one. The biggest is always hard to nail down.
I tend to think about a lot of details and a lot of big picture stuff and then miss the real obvious stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a recent one you're probably more aware of, but like planning this machining summit, right? And put a lot of effort into trying to make sure everybody's welcome, but also like drive to what's most unique about it, which is skiing, and then had a good I had a good friend reach out.
Yeah.
That felt excluded because he couldn't ski.
Yeah.
And I think like my focus on driving to what was unique about the event let me lose focus on the importance of actually making it inclusive.
Yeah.
Which it is, by the way, like you're going to be doing RC cars, and we've been talking about doing RC cars, and it actually is. We chose April because Mammoth is very accessible to people that don't ski at that time. Yeah. But it's so I'm going to end up so laser focused on the mission I'm after that I'll miss little things around the fringes. And that was just, I guess that's one example, but.
Yeah, I saw, we've talked about it. I saw that hit you heavy. I hope I wasn't too dismissive of it. But we all drop things, right? I think someone, when I think of you, I think big, crazy ideas, and dotting every I and crossing every T is not always the thing I think about.
I dot T's and cross I's.
So I know how serious that stuff is to you, and I know how much you've paid extra special care and attention to me with, you know, all my, you know, my gimpy problems with my, you know, broken neck and back and all that. So thanks for sharing that, Al. Let's go to this one. So one thing you learned the hard way about people in the manufacturing industry.
I don't know if I learned it the hard way or not, but one thing I learned about people in the manufacturing industry, I'll tie hard into that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think a lot of people in the manufacturing industry carry a hard persona to protect themselves. And once you crack through it, there's just, an amazing amount of brilliance you can get from it. I shared my bench when I was at the university shop was my back was to a guy, Jack Handy Sides, who's passed away.
Yeah.
We called him Krusty. So what are you making, Jack? Parts. Like he had this hard shell to him.
Yeah.
But I learned more about machining from him than anybody else. Like once he kind of cracked through that hard shell, actually a different bridge model we were making. We were up late. He was helping us. Kevin was helping us and Jack was helping. And Kevin had got himself a big cookie to kind of cover his stuff. And he went to the restroom and Jack was like, he'd always have, like he'd also have fun. He went to the cafeteria and got the exact same size cookie. When Kevin came back to the restroom, he just shoved it in his mouth like the Cookie Monster. There's crumbs falling everywhere. But yeah, I think the thing I learned is don't let the hard persona have you go away from somebody. Those are actually the people you'll learn the most from. And it's been the same thing with customers. Your biggest critics end up being the most valuable people. It's just oftentimes that shell comes from, I think, their opinion not being valued. So then they just protect it But when you kind of, when you get the chance to break through it, then you get like the stuff that's been saved.
Yeah. So I've been a machinist, 25 years. I have a hard time even saying that. And it's been fun to watch how much it's changed. And I've dealt with back when it was very common and normal to basically, you know, razz the new guy, try to set him up to fail, all that. But if there was one thing that helped me get through the industry, it was my ability to just like accept these hard shells and try to get through them. Yeah, most of us are all soft gooey people on the inside. So all right, wrap up the lightning round. Who's your favorite kid? Just kidding.
I have 5 kids.
Al's got a big, beautiful family. So I was kidding about that.
I can pick my favorite goat. Those are called kids.
Yeah. Nobody cares about that. All right, let's transition into the next section, Al. I don't want these interviews I do to become little counseling sessions, but people I care about and respect, which is really the people that I invite to be on this with me. I try to understand like the magic behind Al, like what got you to be who you are? You are a big, crazy thinker, deeply passionate, deeply caring, all that stuff. So, I break it up into, maybe your early life. We just go down some bullet points of like, you know, where, let's just start with your early life, but we'll go early life, kind of finding machining, your machinist, you know, the couple of years you spent in machining, couple of years you spent in teaching, or a handful of years you spent teaching. We'll get into the software side. That's probably where more of my questions are, because that's where you've spent most of your time and where we share the most time. So early years, where'd you grow up? What kind of kid were you?
I grew up in St. Thomas, Ontario. So I've really lived in two towns in my life. This is kind of another funny thing. St. Thomas, Ontario was known for Jumbo the Elephant getting killed by a train.
No way.
So the big old statue of Jumbo the Elephant when you drive into St. Thomas. And now I live in Tehachapi, and it's known for a train going around in a circle to gain elevation. Those are kind of the only two places I've ever lived, other than Bakersfield for 9 months. But that was, that's another story.
Oh, that's odd. I freaking live where I grew up. I've moved away and come back, but that's interesting. We share that. What kind of kid were you? Is that an easy one to define?
You'd definitely describe me as a shy kid. Shy. I'd always have like a best friend at the time, which is, I guess, pretty interesting and ironic. I'm all about community now, but for me, I'd have like.
We share that, Al. I still describe myself as a very shy person, and most people laugh at that. I overcome it, but it's interesting. I would not have guessed that about you. So, when you were a kid, were you building things and pulling things apart or anything? Like what was that like?
Yeah, when I was a kid, I was building forts in the backyard, and my dad would kind of let me experiment and explore quite a bit, rip telephone parts, tell old telephones apart and make an intercom system.
That's awesome.
My grandpa let me take his lawnmower, the one with like the weird front tire that was just offset. If you're old enough to know what that is, you know what that is. So I'd cut people's lawns and built a trailer for my bike to pull my lawnmower and weed whacker around to cut people's lawns. So I think I was always kind of entrepreneuring.
You're blowing my mind right now.
Yeah,
we share that. I had the lawn barber business with a trailer that I took behind my bike.
You know, the annoying thing is I never really thought the pun of like, my name is what? Mow the lawn.
Yeah.
I never thought of that when I was a kid. Instead, I had like to stretch out my long name. Like, so
Mow. My name was pretty easy to put on the side of my trailer. Oh, that's awesome. It's interesting when you get to know people that you click with. how grossly different and crazy similar, you know, how many similarities you have. Yeah. I think of you as like a pretty hands-on person, willing to roll your sleeves up, you know, help put chairs away, help fix something, help whatever. Where do you think, you know, what do you think, where do you think that comes from? Of your youth is
from my youth. Yeah. I think sometimes you learn the most by eavesdropping. I say that to say, like, I remember, we had a family friend, had family mm-hmm. friend from church that ran a very successful developer, the primary developer in the little town we grew up. And I remember overhearing him tell somebody else, good management's invisible. And that just always struck me. That's kind of want to stay out of the way and support. Yeah. And that thinking has evolved over time, but that,
yeah,
I can't remember how young I was, but I remember overhearing that, and it's just always stuck with me.
That's a good one. That's a good one. What'd your family think of when you were committed to, you know, learning how to be a machinist and that being a potential career for you? But before I'll let your brain work on that. You mentioned your dad pulling apart phones and whatnot. Like, can I ask what your parents did? Like, what kind of role models they were?
Mom stayed home and took very, very good care of me.
Good.
To the point I've had to maybe, yeah. So mom stayed home to my wife's deficits sometimes. I don't want to say that as a bad thing towards my mom, but, no. And my dad, basically the whole time I was growing up, he taught the apprentice carpentry program. And we'd like build sheds and do additions for people and stuff over the summer sometimes, but he was a carpenter.
There's no way that had an impact on your life.
Yeah.
I did know that, and I was hoping to get that out. I moved on to next little section of like finding machining. We talked about it, right? So am I right in that your original intent was to basically go be an engineer, a mechanical engineer?
That's what I thought. So I thought I wanted to be an engineer. So in Canada, you kind of take, you're either on track to go to university or on track to go to community college, and the two don't mix. Mm-hmm. We start at community college, you're in community college. So I was on track to go to university, but I was hands-on. So I felt a need to do hands-on stuff. And then like my last year of high school, there was this program that was supposed to be 2 years. I just got 1 year of it, called the YES program, Youth Employment Skills, but it allowed you to start your apprenticeship while you're in high school. So my thinking was, well, I can get my apprenticeship done by the time I'm 20 and still go on to engineering school. And then I ended up with a job at the engineering school and with, like, working with the professors on their passion projects. And,
that's cool. That's cool.
Yeah. And I probably would have flunked out of engineering school. I'm not studious enough.
The moment when I said I had a moment, I knew I was going to be a machinist. I actually had a moment. I was like, I'm going to go be a mechanical engineer, learn how to make bikes. And, I had a machine shop teacher, at Sierra College kind of like nudge me towards being a machinist. Okay. So we've talked about your machining years, I think pretty good. Some of the challenges and, you know, things that you dealt with there. We talked about you transitioning to being a teacher, but let's talk a little bit more. So you got a phone call about being a teacher. Let's talk about why did that feel right?
Because it was a direct answer to prayer in a way I'd never had an answer to prayer before in my life. To be honest, like
that was the first
time in my life I can remember praying and having an immediate answer to it.
That's powerful. That's powerful. That's awesome.
Yeah. Otherwise it would have, like, I was shy. I didn't talk in front of people. Like, everything else about it just didn't fit.
Yeah. Another theme I see, and this is me, your friend, is that you haven't shied away from some pretty big, hard stuff. Have you put thought into, like, what made you that type of person? I'm not trying to psychoanalyze you too much, but I think this is pretty interesting stuff to dig into.
That's always been.
You just like the big, hard stuff?
I do.
Okay. Yeah, I could probably go back and...
I got a story in the tip of my tongue that I'm not sure if I should tell or not, but I should probably tell it.
Yeah, you should absolutely tell it. And then... it's always editing, but let's get to it.
There, it's a bunch of neighborhood kids running around the front yard, and noticed a neighbor we didn't even really know was watching something that maybe shouldn't have been obvious to the kids in the front yard, and we're like, somebody should go knock on his door and just introduce yourselves. I'm like, I'll do it. I don't know what it is about me. I'm like, that seems like a challenge. I'll run into that burning building.
That's definitely not getting it edited out.
Oh crap.
there is something. I've had a lot of time to laying around the last 7 months to think about life. There's something about, sometimes I think it's just in your brain. I don't know if it's even genetic, but
it's like I'm attracted to it. It's like, that's a challenge. Now I can't say no.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm doing sports. Like some people want the ball. Some people want to help the guy with the ball. Right.
Yeah. And I guess that's the thing. I never challenged myself with sports. It kind of, I guess it's a little bit of a regret. I wanted to play high school football and didn't. But I didn't challenge myself that way.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's interesting. Whatever that is.
I don't know if there's anything to it. I mean, you're doing a good job picking at questions, because you're triggering old memories, and who am I that I didn't know.
Yeah. So we're still in the teaching stage. So when you became a teacher, how long do we want to make this? I have a deep passion for teaching. I don't know about being a teacher, but teaching. How was that experience? Like, did you feel like you were pretty well supported for, like, how to structure a class and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah. So, I mean, the benefit I had is I went back and taught at the high school I went to.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so a lot, and it, I was
with people that already vouched for you. So they were kind of invested in your success.
I was 22. Like, I'd graduated 5 years sooner. Like, most of the teachers still knew me.
Yeah.
So I was very, very well supported. Ironically enough, I told them I'd only teach the drafting class if they'd buy me SolidWorks. So they did. Actually, I'm not teaching AutoCAD. The industry's not using that.
Yeah.
So I felt supported from that perspective. There was a grant for one of the schools in our area to get a laser cutter, and I got it. I tended to get what I needed. Had a good mentor that mentored me on how to teach.
And was that another teacher?
That was another teacher. Yeah.
Someone that was already one of your teachers, or
he had been one of my teachers. Yeah.
Cool. That's awesome.
But I was teaching shop. Like, if you looked at the deliverables for the year and the expected outcomes for the course, I could have well structured a 1 week lesson plan and met all the objectives.
That's interesting.
So like I felt like I had a lot of creative freedom to it wasn't like I was teaching one of the standardized classes like math or English. They were all shop classes. So there was a lot of freedom and flexibility for me to bring a passion. And when I did my solid work training business, it was Inspirtech, because to me, I believe the primary job of teaching is to inspire learning. And so it was that I found a lot of fun. And I guess that comes back to like, what do I get joy from? Galvanizing and to kind of galvanizing, inspiring students is kind of one and the same.
Yeah. How many years were you at that school?
Just under two. I taught on a letter of permission, and you could only teach on a letter of permission for 2 years.
Yeah.
And I was denied from the summer school teachers program, because they said I needed 5 years work experience to get the letter of permission. And the teachers college told me that four of my 5 years, I was an apprentice. So that didn't count as work experience. So I was denied from the summer program for teachers college. But then prior to that, I ended up getting married and moving to California. And my wife's amazing, and California's been great to me. So
awesome.
It worked out better. And I should probably tell the good side of the story for that teachers college. I applied a second time.
Yeah.
So after the first summer I applied and was denied, after the second summer, I was actually accepted.
Okay.
But at that point I'd already committed, to move to California.
Committed my life.
That's yeah. I was already moving to California. I'd already met my wife, and I was on my way.
Do you have a couple things from teaching that you feel like is carried across from, I can put little threads from one part of my career to the next and to the next.
Yeah. Check for learning. I one of the little workshops I did was like, always check for learning. And when you're teaching, your goal is to get somebody to be successful on a test. So like along the way, you're checking for learning to verify that somebody's they're coming along with you and learning what you're trying to teach. You're looking for the puzzled look on somebody's face to see if they're, there's a big onus on is the person I'm talking to understanding what I'm saying? Am I articulating the knowledge in a way that they can understand it? That's probably been the most important part of my career in software, not the machining, which I guess I did both for about 2 years when I'm being honest.
Yeah.
The ability to take what I understand and get somebody else to understand it is been really critical. Like I'll remember I did a little less than a year designing wellheads while I was kind of trying to get that business off the ground. I remember one of the trainings I went in, we watched PowerPoints for the day, and at the end the guy said, "Now you've been indoctrinated." Like, no, you haven't taught somebody by just showing them a PowerPoint. But that's generally speaking how the working world thinks, that doesn't think about teaching, and you've got to like check for understanding along the way. I think that's been very, very helpful for me.
Good. Let's move on to entering the software world. So my version that you can clean up is you fell in love. You're moving to California, and Inspirtech, that was the idea. I'm going to go start this. Am I right there?
Yeah, I did. So what I realized when I was teaching is teachers aren't teaching the new technology because they don't want to. It's like it wasn't that the teacher still wanted to be teaching the drafting board. It's just that's what they did in industry when they left industry. And you want to teach from a place of confidence. But many other teachers wanted to teach what I was teaching. They just needed a way to facilitate it. So I was taking the curriculum I was doing and saying, like, I can flip it so the teacher can be the facilitator. Because at the same time, like the second day in my class, I'll never remember the kid's name's Johnny. We do these sessions on ninth graders a month in and try and check to see which ninth graders were were maybe at risk that as teachers we should put extra care into.
Okay.
I remember the math teacher telling me Johnny's on my list. I'm like, Johnny, he's my peer tutor. Like, third day in SolidWorks and he's driving an engine block with pistons going up and down. The kid's smart. Like, this is, if he's struggling in math, he's struggling to be inspired by what you're doing. It's not that he's not crazy smart.
Yeah.
And then so everybody just learns at different speeds, but education is like reduced to the lowest common denominator of the speed that everybody can learn at. So to me, it was a chance to help create content so the teacher could facilitate the learning as opposed to be the bottleneck. And I think I take that teaching style into management too. It's my job to remove obstacles, not be the obstacle. I hate keeping people waiting. Mm-hmm. I hate being the obstacle. And in teaching, I was the obstacle for a bunch of students that could go excel because I wanted to go help some other people that needed help. And I had 8 months where I was waiting on a work permit because I got married, moved to California, and then applied for a green card and citizenship after I was here. So I was waiting 8 months on getting my green card. Yeah. So I used that time to create the video curriculum.
Okay. So am I right in that it was a means to an end is what I was going to say. That seems less good than I want it to be. But like you were going to start this to basically facilitate, you know, you having this relationship with your wife, right?
It was a bit both. Like she thought she was going to move to Canada when we got married, and I thought I'd just keep teaching. But in parallel, I had applied to SolidWorks to be a solution partner so that I could share my content with other teachers. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when we made the decision that we were going to be moving to California and not there, the same week I got approved from SolidWorks to be a solution partner. So it just kind of happened. It wasn't my intention to be the main thing. She had a job teaching. So I'm like, okay, well then you can teach and I'll get this thing going. So
how long did you do that business? And I think it's a little more gray
I think like pretty five-ish years. The last couple years, honestly, SolidWorks wasn't changing very much. And I started transitioning to spending more of my time creating content for HSMWorks and using that content to drive HSMWorks sales.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's probably 5 or 6 years.
Okay. So 2 or 3 almost more pretty focused on it, it sounds like.
Yeah, 2 or 3 very focused on it. And then the last two was sort of like, that was a good chunk of my income, and selling HSMWorks was a good chunk of my income.
Yeah. That feels like a good transition to how the heck did all that come together? All that meaning... it's probably a good story for the audience to go from solution, you know, basically helping teachers teach SolidWorks, the most simple. How did you get going from basically teaching, helping educators teach SolidWorks to how did you get hooked up with HSM people and start kind of heading that direction?
I developed a network of SolidWorks resellers that were selling my curriculum to schools.
Yep.
So it's kind of selling it in 3 ways. Half of the sales were actually to like people that wanted to learn SolidWorks that were from industry. And that was like my moment where I was learning is learning. It doesn't matter if you're a 10th grader or you're a 60-year-old that's moving from the drafting board to CAD, learning's learning. So sold the same content in both cases and actually really have a disdain for education that gets trivialized. Like the schools want professional content and professionals want well-structured educational content. It's like, why are we doing anyway?
Yeah.
I had one of the partners was working with me to say, let's build some SolidWorks content now. So they had actually connected me with CamWorks because that's what they were selling. And then we went and wanted some written curriculum. So Charles Davis had written CNC Handbook, which I still think is the best handbook out there. So we found that we were pairing his handbook with the CamWorks training I was starting to create. And he said, I mean, you can use my book, but this HSMWorks stuff is way better. And then I went and tried HSM Marshall. Like, oh my goodness, I've seen the light. it was all of a sudden cam that actually worked like SolidWorks. It was pretty incredible. So I'm like, hard pivot. I'm going to do the educational content on that. And then I'd been talking with Anthony Graves, and we were looking at the market, and they were trying to find their space in the market. And, like 5% of their sales were 2.5 access, but it's 60% of the market. I'm like, why don't you give that away? Like, it's 5% of your sales and it addresses 60% of the market. And so we kind of together, and I'm not going to take credit or give credit or whatever it is. It was a conversation we were having on the phone with the three of us, me, Charles, and Anthony. I don't think if any one of us were removed from the equation, it probably wouldn't have happened. So anyway, that kind of led to like, okay, well, and then this is it with Anthony's brilliance. Well, it has to be good enough to give away. And people have to be able to use it on your own. So Al, your curriculum has to go into this so that people can use it. Brene, who's leading HSMers, we got to build our own stock simulation because we can't give cam away that doesn't have stock simulation. So that's when the fast mode HSMer steps ammunition came so that we could make HSMers Express good enough to give away.
Yeah.
And then my content was like, well, obviously we got to give my content away so people can use it. And the revenue from my content is now going to come from selling HSM Works. So I'll lean into the sales side of HSM Works. So it was like a whole lot of stuff just realigned itself based on how the puzzle pieces fit back together.
Interesting. So you and Anthony Graves, let's start with who's Anthony Graves, Al?
Anthony Graves is a good friend. He was kind of a key person in Predator Software and then at Simco. And ran marketing and product for HSM Works.
Yeah.
And then was at Autodesk with us for a couple of years.
Yeah.
But if you're in this industry and you don't know Anthony Graves, then
I think there's a lot of youngsters that
a lot of youngsters. Yeah, that's part of the deal. The
youngsters, not youngsters.
Yeah, but if you're a youngster, you don't know Anthony Graves, and if you've been in the industry for a while, you know him pretty well.
Yeah, yeah. So I've become.
And I think I learned a lot of my. He was an extremely influential person for me in community building.
Mm-hmm.
So who is Anthony Graves? Anthony Graves is the guy at Amerimold. We're walking by the Hypermel booth and he looks at the Hypermel booth and says, those wrinkles are unacceptable. Walks to our booth to get the steamer, steams the wrinkles out of it, puts the steamer back at our booth and goes on with the day and never even tells him he did it.
Yeah.
That's Anthony Graves.
Yeah. I've gotten to know Anthony. I consider him a pretty good friend now. He's a bigger than life kind of character. He's definitely a crazy idea person.
Yep.
So that leads me to the question that just popped in my head. So you, Charles, and Anthony are on a call talking, basically brainstorming the HSM Express idea. I know you and Anthony are big crazy idea people. So I'm going to give a plug out to the Working Genius. So Al mentioned the Working Genius. There's a really good book. At the very least, understand the concepts of it. I think it could be perspective changing for a lot of people. The general concept of, you know, I have a couple of these categories that like energize me and feed me, a couple I'm fine at and a couple that I might even be good at, but they drain me. That was a little bit life-changing for me. So following that kind of mindset or thinking, explain Charles a little bit for me. I've talked to him, I think, once. I don't know him well. I definitely don't know how to categorize the type of person he is in this three-person conversation is that what I'm specifically kind of talking about.
If you write a book, you've obviously got tenacity and you love enabling people. I don't know his Working Genius, but very, very detail oriented. That book that he did is just, I think he did a phenomenal job in the graphics and explaining how to use a Haas control and set up a, like, I don't think there's anything close to how he did that.
Yeah.
I'd say he was the one that told me, Al, the person listening is the one in control of the sales process. Very, very thoughtful. He's retired now. And I think he spends most of his time like volunteering at the Boys and Girls Club. So
cool.
Very,
I think that all says a lot.
Oriented, thoughtful.
I think that all says a lot. Yeah. So quick plug to that book. You mentioned a few times. So CNC Handbook is what I believe it's called. Am I right there?
I can't, the name kind of evolved because it,
yeah,
we so made it part of HSM Works and then Autodesk.
Autodesk bought the rights to it. Here's what I wanted to do is any, especially educators that are, or Brilliant. Educators, people mentoring young machinists, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's free to download from Autodesk if you can still find it on the internet.
Still find it on the Simco webpage too, because there's a couple people with rights to the book.
Yeah, I would be Googling CNC. What were we just calling?
CNC Handbook. I think
CNC Handbook is the, yeah. I've found it typing CNC Handbook Autodesk. A lot. I know a lot of teachers that use it as their. As their textbook. And it's great, especially when you want to visualize, you know, lots of different things in our trade. So that's awesome. Okay. So the three of you are talking about HSM Works or HSM Express. I can make up the story in my head. You and Anthony are pushing this snowball down a hill. Neither of you guys are trying to make it smaller.
I'm not trying to take Charles out of the equation, but then like Anthony and I would just love riffing on stuff. And
yeah.
We like from there, we just make it better. This can make it better. And then we can, Anthony's taking it big.
Yeah. I'm not trying to loop Charles out of it either. Is Charles sitting there like being the tenacious guy? Is he like actually trying to like think through the making it a reality or,
I think a lot of the momentum got building with Anthony and I just growing ideas around.
That's awesome. Sure. That's awesome. Okay. So now you've got to lean into basically selling HSM Works in America. Was it all of America, right?
I was focused on Charles and I, so I was selling HSM Works via Charles and Next Gen Cam.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd partnered at that point, and we were focused on most of America. There's like some SolidWorks wires that were also carrying it that were in different, on the East Coast.
Okay. But
yeah.
So that's worth calling out. I think a lot of people know about Next Gen Cam, through HSM, Fusion Sales, different Autodesk cam sales. My knowledge is that started with Charles and then you became a big part of it. And then, I actually remember, the day I went online to try to get a quote or something. It was like 2 minutes later. Al freaking what, some dude, I couldn't pronounce his last name. It's what Mo, like Mo the Lawn or like Curly and Mo. Yeah, you called. We had a short chat. I remember being like, it's kind of cool. This seems pretty easy to talk about, but I don't have time for this. And I remember you saying, hey, well, I just sent you a full usable demo. Try it out. Go machine some stuff with it. There's a free post for the Haas you're running. And it changed my life, Al. Like that was a point in time that was like, man, I think my life just took a direction that I don't understand yet. I at the time was pretty proficient, you know, professional in Mastercam, and I was working through a dynamic milling on this part that it wasn't really doing what I wanted. And first thing I did, which is literally the thing I tell everybody not to do. Whenever you're evaluating a new tool, software specifically, most people in our industry wants to take the thing that kicked their ass the hardest, the most recent, and put it through this new tool they're evaluating. And that's exactly what I did. I didn't actually expect it to do everything, but I just wanted to see real quick how it could do this one. It was a 3D adaptive, and I was like, holy crap, that's what I've been trying to do. And later on, I found out, you know, some of the interesting HSM, you know, Mastercam history. And yeah, anyways, so then I, long story short, I went and started the shop for L3 Communications. And I think the check that we sent was to Next Gen Cam when you were my sales and apps guy.
I had somebody tell me I would never close it because you were in a big company and it was never going to happen.
The funny story there was, I was told I had budget. I saw the budget allocated, and because it was a new software to this monster company that's never been implemented and all that, I just kept like roadblock after roadblock after roadblock. I had to write some like just ridiculously long justification, you know, for buying a less expensive software. And you kept, so the interesting part of that is I kept talking to you and you're like, no, extend your trial. I understand where you're at. And I knew you were getting heat from the background, but, I did buy it. I bought, several seats of it, as we grew that shop. I just got a call last week, from the guy running that shop now. He's having some problems with HSM. It's kind of a bummer deal. Hopefully he sorts that out with Autodesk. He plays with Fusion, but they're having a challenge with Fusion at a very, very ITAR lockdown company. So
I care way too much about people and my relationships, so I'm glad that is not my problem anymore.
As am I. I think maybe I said that in the phone call. So either way, they'll get it sorted out. I'm still there.
I genuinely want to spend my life solving real technical problems, not anyway.
Yeah. So transitioning from being a machinist, being a teacher, to basically using the tools, teaching the tools, and then you transition to Autodesk. So I also remember I talked to you within hours of you finding out that Autodesk was buying HSMWorks. And I remember you just had like a real human moment. Like you seemed pretty uncomfortable, to be honest, because you talked about you just had a, you know, big meeting with everybody in the Next Gen company.
Big meeting the Next Gen company. The Next Gen company was Al and Charles.
But so, you had a big focused meeting about where you're taking the future was the thing.
Yeah, we had big plans for what we were doing. We actually, the same day, we got a 30 seat PO from a government contract that got pulled back as soon as they saw that Autodesk had acquired it. And there was risk for the future of the product would be. We were told we could keep selling it for a while, but we had to get our contract with Autodesk. I'm like, I don't know where this is going to go. I'd like to care about this industry. I can't sell anything until I know what's going on. So it was, it was certainly like, oh boy, what just happened?
Yeah. So I was happy as a clam. HSM was still in its very, so we're talking 2011, fast forward to 2013, 14, 15, whatever it was. I was happy. HSM was still a maturing product, but it did, you know, all the big aerospace stuff that I worked on, it did it really well. I was able to teach, you know, new people into the shop. You know, it was great for me. You and I had become, I would say, business friends, like, you know,
not friends yet, but good, strong business acquaintances at that point.
Yeah. You actually invited me to come down to Pier 9 to talk to an HSM user group.
That's great.
And you, Al, are responsible for me making my very first PowerPoint. I was Yeah.
Welcome to my pain.
Unfortunately, I cannot share how many PowerPoints I've made after coming to Autodesk, but I was trying to kind of shape the story that I was going to share, and I was like, ah, screw it. I'm gonna try to make a PowerPoint. I made myself a little PowerPoint to help kind of tell the story, and yeah, it was funny. I remember, like, my main talking point was like, it just works. Like, I know that's not like a ShamWow kind of sales point, but it was funny. I had a couple people come up to me, and they were like, oh, that resonates with me. It just works. But so, yeah, we came pretty good, you know, business acquaintance, you know, business friend type people. And then I called you again. Fast forward some number of years, I called you again on the same, I believe it was the same day that Anthony Graves gave notice.
The number of times things like this have just worked out in my career is like, I couldn't come up with all the stories.
Yeah.
But for me to take, I'm going to tell my part of the story now.
Yeah.
If I can.
Yeah. Yeah.
For me to accept the job as I was the
only, no, only, Adam Smith just started.
Adam Smith started. Was just starting, but
yeah.
Obviously for me to take the next step forward, I had to make myself irrelevant and backfill myself. So I'm like, well, I want to go be product manager. I can't. And it's not that I wanted to yet. Actually, it was something I wanted to do. I didn't feel like I was ready. And that's where kind of Carl's encouragement was so impactful to me. But also like it, how do we backfill for me? And you were the first person I could think of as being the right person. I'm like, I can't reach out to a customer and poach them. And then I get an email from you. Will you write me a letter of recommendation for a job? I'm like,
yeah,
yes, yeah. But
yeah, I was exploring, a position with a machine tool builder. And I actually was looking for people to talk me out of it. And so I was just called several people I knew, and you were one of them. And I think applied for it, and I ended up turning the job down. But yeah. And then you were like, software. And I was like, what? That's a change of direction. And man, what a ride it has been, Al. So that would have been, I think 10 and a half, 11 years ago, coming up.
We did about 10 years at Autodesk.
Yeah. Yeah. So quite a story from my perspective, but you, let's talk a little bit about that transition from like using the tool, teaching the tool, and what was it like now that you're at Autodesk?
Drowning.
Yeah. What?
It was like drowning.
Drowning. Man, so a lot of people.
I took on product management for CAM 2 weeks before we were going to release. It was at the time called CAM 360. It was going to be CAM 360, and then Carl said, "This is crazy. Like the whole point is to pull all CAD and CAM together." So then all of a sudden, I find out like we used to be selling HSM marks for $8,000. CAM is going to be inside Fusion for $300 a year. Like, oh, how on earth do we possibly do this? At the time, like, we were giving posts away, but there was still a lot of custom post edits happening. A
lot, yeah.
So I'm drowning in that. I'm drowning in the fact that Autodesk has got this massive sales team, and you're getting just Fusion support of Witchy Tushy 7000. Like, that's a punch press. No. Like, it was... It was like, it's feeling of just absolute drowning of like, I've got to figure out how to focus this product that I know and I love and I can serve a need, but it's like, I'm just drowning. And that's why I knew I needed somebody like you to come help. Like the backfill couldn't have me drown more, but needed to be somebody better than me, and you're a better machinist. So at least it was an upgrade.
I remember having early Autodesk conversations with you feeling like I was drowning.
We're not drowning now though, right?
No, not at all. I started early February, and by the end of the year, before like early December, I had like 160 nights in a Hilton hotel. Yeah. So it was, hit it hard. hit it everywhere. But it was an adventure I wouldn't turn down for nothing. Let's talk about what was the hardest part? So we talked about that, right? You had to come up with a way to scale the business, but what do you think the hardest part of joining this big monster? Autodesk is I don't want to call them a monster, right? But they're a big ship that's heading in one direction really fast, right? And what do you think? What was like the biggest maybe challenge or two that you can publicly share as kind of taking on that product manager role? And you grew in that role all the way up to basically director of all things manufacturing for Autodesk. But give me some of the kind of the early challenges beyond what you just shared.
The earliest one is I think learning how to say no. I don't know. There's this line from a movie that I thought was good. Now I watched it again. It wasn't all that great, but the big hit, Mark Wahlberg is an assassin, and he says this statement like, "I can't stand the idea of anybody not liking me." It's like, you're an assassin. They don't. But I can't stand the idea of anybody not liking me. So learning to say no, was probably the hard thing, and that was the only way. But that was the only way we were successful. Like that drowning of. We're at a mirror mold. We're selling HSM work because it's like got super fast toolpath calculation time. So we should be selling it to mold and die shops. We're missing all the other stuff you need to actually machine a mold, right? And kind of getting to that place of like I was finally just felt like maybe drowning so bad that it's like that's where the if it doesn't have a red H on it, just leave me alone until you find all the red H's. Like it, I got forced into a position where I literally would felt like I would drown if I didn't get focus. But that was extremely helpful for me. Yeah, but it wouldn't have gotten where because I prefer to say yes.
For some context on that, right? A lot of I remember my early days at Autodesk. I was getting pulled in all these major account deals where the context of that is Autodesk makes so many different pieces of software, and they do little tiny deals with local startup machine shop, and then they do these multi-trillion, billion, zillion-dollar deals with these big monsters. And so a lot of the groups you work with at Autodesk are used to doing crazy high touch, crazy involved implementations with some big software, right? And that's not the position we were in on those early CAM days. So yeah, that was from being on I was sales applications, and being on that side, it was definitely helpful for us to be like, no, we got a pretty narrow focus. We're going to do this really well as we grow the business. Any
You and
key?
I, we would have both drowned. There's like four of us that knew how to use the software at the time. I'll
Yeah.
jokingly say when I started, there was 10 people in the company that could run a machine. Fusion, or it was Kevin. I say Fusion and Kevin in the same word, but Kevin was one of them. Carl Bass was another one. We were two of them. Adam Smith, like the list was pretty short at
Pretty
that time.
short, yeah.
And we were literally drowning. So we were forced to find focus.
So is there any key turning point kind of moments that shaped you and you feel like this got me ready for the position you're in now?
Yeah, there's like a couple. Carl's probably part of most of them. If not all of them. Some heavy decisions where I'd go to Carl for advice and an advisor, and I never really understood it, but sometimes like some situations where I would have hoped he would have like paved the way for me. A certain IMTS booth was one of them, or to solution was just send a bunch of t-shirts and then figure it out. But I think he did a great job kind of knowing what I was capable of and having confidence I was more capable than I knew myself and putting me in the allowing me to be in those situations. A couple times I'd go to him for advice and he's like, well, you're not really valuable to the company until you're willing to be fired over the right decision. Thanks. But yeah, there was a few meetings that I can think through where I was not making a decision that was the decision the group was thinking and feeling like the weight of it.
Yeah.
So I feel like that being in that position of being willing to make that decision while also having the support of a mentor, the safety of a mentor, was good, because now I'm kind of standing on the hill alone. I'm not saying I don't still have mentors, but, the personal safety, and that's a lot different than it was then.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I definitely can think back through several times. I stood up maybe two times at Autodesk where I was like, no, this is the right decision. Worried that it, let me be clear. Autodesk is a freaking wonderful place to work.
Amazing people. But a large organization is optimized to make the decision that is the most likely to succeed. And sometimes the right decision is a courageous, risky decision. Yeah. And it should be hard to make those courageous, risky decisions, or you'd make too many of them. Like it, by definition, it should be hard. If it was too easy, the company would flop all over the place. So I don't say that to say anything bad against the people or the process.
Yeah. And I'll say, just from my little peon perspective, it's extra hard when you know it's a really good gig, right?
Very good gig.
And I stood up a couple times where I was like, I think I'm kind of risking my career. And one of the things I respect about you, and I'm not trying to make this a fluff owl piece, but you, more than maybe anybody I know while at Autodesk, you know, Andrew's probably a different, there's lots of the Andrew level leadership that, I think they're doing it daily almost. Right. But, I think that's what I've always admired about you. You know, if you feel strongly about something, you're willing to, listen, learn from people, and then, you know, take a position that might not end what feels like very well. So, kudos to you for having
that. I certainly learned that skill. At Autodesk. And so the only way I learned it is, the truth is, like, I was probably more fearful than I should have after each of many of those decisions afterwards. The group that I had a different perspective in it that I thought would kind of shove me to the side if I made the wrong decision, like, were all instantly supportive once the decision was made. So the Autodesk culture was very supportive of me learning that, even though I still felt the decision was risky. It really wasn't. I was safe as an individual. And the people there are great. So that, I mean, that's the career thing. If I said, teaching taught me how to articulate knowledge, Autodesk taught me how to make hard decisions.
Yeah. And you say safe. I mean, that's safe if everybody doesn't belly flop together.
Well, I mean, there's a sense of risk in everything, but there's definitely company cultures where it's like, you will feel the pain if you go against the crowd. That was not Autodesk. Like any big organization tends to think as a group, but there is definitely not adverse. I never felt adverse reactions when I didn't think as the group. Still painful, but as a culture, I don't think there's many other companies that size that I could have learned that.
Yeah. I'm beyond grateful for the time I had at Autodesk, the friends I have still have there. We had Kevin Schneider on here. We've got a few more Autodeskers queued up to do another one of these.
Daniel, who I reported to, is now on the board for Toolpath. So yeah, it's a fun.
Yeah. I have some lifelong friendships there that I'll appreciate for forever and cherish forever. Let's talk about this kind of long arc, you know, over to Toolpath. I say long arc because it was your time at Autodesk. I think really needed to be that amount of time at Autodesk to get you ready to be a leader of Toolpath. Toolpath is not an easy problem to solve. And I think we have the right people in place to solve it. So let's start with just the easiest. Probably not at all the easiest one, but why Toolpath? It's the shortest question, but it might be hardest to articulate.
Trusting the people. A couple of things I told you I told you that it felt like, genuinely felt like it was a direct answer to prayer. So that there was that, obviously. And then the second bit, it was still a hard decision. I went and told them like, I need a week or two to think about it. And I was actually, I had the week off. I was building houses in Mexico with my son. Not that that detail matters, but I tend to remember the details of my surroundings when I'm kind of in those hard decisions. And then I came back and like, it come down to like the timeline. Like I met with Justin and Andy three times over the course of the week. And you will remember one time Andy's like, well, I thought we were joining the call to get the good news. And I was still stressing out over the decision. I kind of came back down to like the last minute. I really had to decide, because the following, I was going to be committed to some planning meetings that would have been inappropriate for me to be a part of if I took the new job.
Yeah.
The software wasn't working that day. It was just broken. And that was why at the end, I'm like, in the end, I've built a career betting on people.
Yeah.
I trust Justin, our CTO.
Yeah.
He's got his problems, as all of us do, but I trust him. I trust him to solve the hard problems.
Yep.
I believe I've freed him up to solve more hard problems. But yeah, the software didn't work and I was stressing on it. And then it just hit me. I'm making my bet on people because we've got a lot of hard problems we've got to solve.
Yeah.
And I trust these people.
What gap do you think, going back and thinking about that time, like what did you see Toolpath, filling for the industry?
It's less about what they're filling for the industry and more about the spot they were in. Cause I kind of had a couple core convictions, that I was like pressure testing against how I could pull it off. And I didn't really have a solution of how I was going to pull it off. I just had a couple core convictions about what was next. Genuinely believe that machines needed to be a part of the process. I think when we were starting at HSMWorks, what I believe is like, it feels barbaric that a CAM tool has subpar CAD tools. Like we can't do our job without good geometry creation. That was the biggest break. The more we were doing in Fusion, the more I felt like a connection to the machine and closing that loop was the next critical step. And so there was that piece. There was the piece of thinking like, and this is the weird one to say, but the piece of thinking like the business, but we have to think a little bit differently about the business model. It always bothered me. Like CJ is the most important story I'll use, but he's a one man shop that always wants to be a one man shop. He just wants to be a one man shop with 50 machines instead of five. And the CAM business model is not set to scale. It's just like, well, we're just going to charge you more per user, or we're going to go find other users. And I think AI needs to kind of increase productivity. And so we need a way where we can grow with the shop and in a proper way. And I think I just felt like it'd be easier for a startup to do that. And then also like when I saw Toolpath, like I didn't believe the pushy the dummy part pops out story at all ever. But Justin described what he was building as AI that shows its homework and allows the user to adjust with what they're doing. And then I kind of took that to my feeling of, well, whether it's the user or the machine that's adding the constraints, it's really a constraint-based system that's just at a higher level. In parametric CAD-CAM, you're constraining kind of specifically like a constraint to this geometry or a constraint to stay parallel or horizontal. And I could understand how Toolpath works. It's just, I'm constraining to this set of tools. I'm constraining to this set of processes. So like that all made sense. I could see that it was a browser-based system where you could say, I can see a world where the machine can say, these are the tools I have, and I'm constrained to that. And now there's a valuable reason to tie the machine in so that we can grow a business as we get a shop to have more machines. Then we're motivated to continue to make a shop more productive, not motivated to go find somebody else as a customer. So the people clicked. It was early enough in the process it clicked. I don't know if I should say this out loud, but... I believe that the real opportunity is to connect the broad set of puzzle pieces. And there's a lot of solved problems. Chatter, machine connectivity is one. There's other problems that all need to come together. But at this point in time, the most likely technology to raise the kind of money necessary to put it all together, outside of being a part of a big company that makes the bet, was an AI company, and Toolpath was an AI company, and an AI company that hadn't raised and burned and wasted their runway yet. Others have come into this space and burned through the large amounts of money already. Yeah. Toolpath had started, but hadn't burned their opportunity yet. The opportunity is still in front of us to demonstrate how we think this all comes together.
Yeah. How I did
it came out well or not?
No, that, I think that works.
And I can't write a line of code to save my life. So it was sort of like I was starting a company, I hire you, you've proved it.
Yeah. Outside of like how to warm my machine up, like a couple lines to do a warm up cycle, I'm the same. I can't, maybe I can turn my fourth axis the opposite direction. That's about as much as the code as I
never made a post myself, like a working post processor myself. Dyslexia gets in my way too much. I can't write code
for sure. Another thing we have in common is you, lots of machinists. All right, so we've done some very interesting things at Toolpath. What do you feel like was the biggest risk you've taken at Toolpath? You're not far. You're a year and a half in, right?
Our MTS booth was a pretty good size risk.
I kind of knew the answer to that.
Yeah, that was a stressful one. It felt like the right thing to do. And I think you say, and I agree, if it's worth doing, it's worth overdoing. We probably overdid it more than we needed to. I knew we wanted a booth in the machine hall. And the booth we got was the booth that was available, but it was more than I wanted to do.
Worked out great.
Kind of compare the spend on that to the runway we had at the time. That was a big one.
From anybody that was at IMTS last year, hopefully you stopped by and saw. It was a real fun event for us. We appreciated everybody stopping by. Made a lot of great connections. From my perspective, I think maybe that's interesting. So when I accepted the position at Toolpath, the conversation was, we're going to IMTS to basically walk around, make connections, do that kind of stuff.
That was the current thought at the time.
2 weeks later, when I started, your first conversation we had was, we need to decide if we're going to IMTS. And I had a sinking feeling in my stomach, like, oh man, are we already out of money? We can't even go to IMTS. And it was like, oh, no, we're trying to decide, do we go or do we go have a booth? And I remember,
we go.
Yeah. I remember scrambling for my calendar and being like, Al, it's like 90 days away, 93 days or whatever the time was. And I was like, I don't know if we can even physically, do it. And that definitely consumed a lot of my early 90 days.
I think I have a picture of you sleeping on the floor in the IMTS booth.
Probably, yeah. Justin and I were there for almost 2 weeks. So it was a good chunk leading up. And then my voice, shout out to Tyler Bondi. He brought me over some tea to get my voice back. And yeah, that was a good event. This next IMTS should also expect it to be pretty good. What's the biggest doubt you had? Was it also IMTS?
Oh, I've had a lot of doubts.
Yeah.
I think that's probably my job, though, is to evaluate the worries and prioritize the worries.
Yeah.
I tend to stare at the, like, I don't. Since it's machinists listening to this, it's probably it's probably interesting for you to understand sort of the CEO part of the bit I'm learning, and I'm only explaining something I'm coming to learn.
Yeah.
But when we're growing a business through venture capital, you're raising money to continue to fund the dream. And you effectively do that, like, each round, more or less, you sell about 20% of the company, because anybody getting involved wants to be involved in a significant enough way. And there'll be a lead in the round and some smaller players, but somebody's got to lead the round, which they're probably going to want 10 to 15%, right? So then you've got the others that participate. So you're selling about 20% of the company. And the way it goes is kind of like a construction loan. I've got an idea. It's a $100 idea. I'll sell you 20% of the idea for $20. And you take that $20 and prove that the market likes this idea. So now this idea is worth $1,000. I'll sell 20% of the company for $200. And then you take that $200 and you grow it more. And so what I have to balance is how do we establish that runway? Because you don't, if you raise $200 to last you 10 years, then you sold too much of the company and you got to sell more of the company. You need to keep that company to keep selling pieces of it, to keep growing the idea, or you need to just instantly become profitable. But especially on what we're doing, of something that's such deep tech and so wide, we're investing heavily in the foundation and proving that we're building something and playing the long game is the only way I like to play. So yeah, the thing I'm constantly worried about is, like, Joe Bailey would always say, like, there's two elevators moving past each other and you got to time the right time to jump. I think that's always the thing that I'm trying to time, is like, when's the right time to, like, leap forward, and when's the time to kind of keep pace? And it's like, we're starting to get some traction. No, we're not getting traction. So I worry and I doubt myself and my ability to balance all that timing. I have a deep conviction that this is a solvable problem. I have a deep conviction this team is the most likely to solve it. My biggest worry is I fail in my job keeping the runway paved in front of the team that I know can do it.
Yeah.
And if you make the runway too long and narrow, then you don't establish the momentum you need to. And if you make the runway too fat and short, you're run out of cash before you got the plane off the ground.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good share. Is there any moments that stand out as, like, really, I mean, I think both of us can say that, you know, before I started, I felt like we were onto something. I'm a technical person. I still like to think I'm a machinist. I'd used Toolpath way before it was ready for showtime. But it felt to me like it was the first time an automated cam tool, like, you could see it thinking the way I think. So for me, that was like my first, I think this is on to something. I'm going to go try to be a part of it so I can put my thumbprint on it and make sure they don't F it up. Yeah. And then for me, like, the next big time that I really felt like we were onto something, really the next one was seeing how excited people were at IMTS. But, I think it was when I went to the next real one was when I went to, James Dyer's, shop and had a conversation with him about how much we were changing, you know, everything he was doing. And, do you have, like, one or two kind of examples of when you were like, holy crap, we're on to something? Did I steal all your good ones?
You stole a bunch of the good ones. I'm going to take a different one.
Yeah.
Westech, like, 2 months ago.
Yeah. Yeah. Something like that.
Yeah. That's where this whole idea of, like, let's do the summit on the summit happened. And the idea just kind of, like, clicked quickly. But the one that was interesting for me, you were a part of it in the early days of trying to establish a presence for what we were doing at Autodesk in the CAM market. It felt like years before people would take us seriously.
Yeah.
At Westech, somebody had gone on our chat to try and get my phone who worked for a tooling vendor that really wanted to get a hold of me because I was there, because they wanted to work with us.
That's awesome.
And we're like a year and a half into being in this market in a serious way. It took a lot longer than that the last time to start to feel the momentum shift.
Yeah.
And the headwind turn into a bit of a tailwind. So I felt that tailwind of people wanting to work with us and get their tools into our platform and believing in what we were doing. And then the planning this trip and feeling the tailwind get behind it so quickly, of believing in this kind of idea of like, we're going to get together in a different way than we've gotten together before.
Yeah.
And I say all that because I believe there's a lot of, as we go through this change and how automation can change how we do our work, the people that are a part of automation now, there's an exciting change for all of us. And the only way that we'll be a part of it, yeah, we got to solve the technology problem, but we have to help the community kind of evolve and use the tools in a new way. And that's like 100,000 small one-man shops all over the world. It's not like some big company. So to me, being able to have the community start, both vendors and companies get behind what we're doing, well, it's like, well, I know we can solve the problem. If you get the right people, we'll go solve the problem.
Yeah.
So that was probably the biggest kind of turning point. But again, now you're the one responsible to make sure we can actually make parts, and I'm more hands down on the go to market side. So that's why my answer is this one.
I mean, I didn't ask myself the question, but I'll share it. Like since I broke my neck and back a while ago, I've transitioned to spending, my schedule is a little harder to manage because my body, dictates that sometimes, but I spend a ton of time basically making parts in my garage and my Haas machine and documenting, what needs to be better and really pushing on the software. And it's been, I can tell you, my desk and my bookshelf are scattered with parts that feel like little milestones to me. Like I see this feature and I'm like, man, we're handling this with a very credible way. It's been an interesting transition for me, switching more to the product focused person. I have lots of like, I think we're getting there. And then
there's not a machinist in the world I trust more than you, though, Tim. Seriously.
That's a huge compliment. We internally say that me and Andy are probably our two biggest critics.
And you should be.
I believe I'm probably the biggest critic.
I'd say Andy's the biggest critic on the experience and you're the biggest critic on the machining. Like Kill often say, like, we need to rip people's faces off with the magical moment that they experience. Yeah.
My career has been interesting. And when I reflect on it, I thought I hated CAM automation. I thought I was so smart and clever that, you couldn't automate, what I do. But in reality, I've been trying to automate what I do for 20 years now. And it's been fun to kind of sit back and reflect on how the industry's changed and what we're doing at Toolpath. So that's really fun for me. So I've got two questions for you. I'll start with, what does a success look like for Toolpath? I know this is like, sounds like the dumbest, lamest corporate, question ever, but what I really care about is between now and IMTS. So for anybody listening at different times, IMTS is 10 months away, something like that. Yeah. And then let's just skip way forward ahead, 10 years from now, something like that.
Yeah. Okay. So I think you're kind of talking about that through, I'll call it two horizons.
Yeah. Yeah.
At its core, successful Fusion, to me, we exist to make people machining parts more productive. That's kind of at the core of what we're doing. So our success is defined by our ability to make shops more productive. I think through the lens of the human to machine ratio is the measure of productivity. Right now, on average, the industry is about one CNC programmer, one CAM programmer per 2.5-3 machines. And we need to make that number dramatically bigger. And as we make it bigger, I believe the world is just going to consume more machined parts. I don't think there's going to be less machinists. I think there might actually be more. The autopilot made more pilots and more people had access to travel. But the pilot now takes over in a heavy crosswind landing, flies a bigger plane, turns it around faster to become the navigator. I'm off on a rant. Yeah. At the core, though, our success is how do we make machinists more productive? In the near term, to me, that's about improving the productivity of the work that comes through. Today, it's pretty broken. You get a part, you quote, you should throw your finger up in the air, you come up with a number. And then the programmer takes over and programs the part. And oftentimes that programmer is the same person just 3 months later saying, "You idiot, what were you thinking when you did that?" I'm going to program this completely differently and use a different set of tools. And then it goes to the operator, which is often the same person who also says, "You dummy, speeds and feeds are all wrong. Feed hold override. I'm going to adjust all that." And that never kind of gets better. That cycle recycles itself, and we joke about that all the time about coding. Like every developer looks at somebody else's code and says they should do it differently. Yeah. We look at our own code too. So whether it's we're judging ourselves or somebody else, to me, the process of accepting work, planning the work, and executing the work is very broken. And we can, in the short term, we should deliver on connecting that process better. And that's what Toolpath is selling today. To me, the following that, the thing that we should be able to unlock productivity for shops is, I think about CJ and I think about, if you're making an aerospace looking connector that'll fit in a 1¾-inch bar, nobody's going to make it faster, better, and a higher quality than CJ. But it's really hard to find the work that's a fit for you. So most shops end up kind of trying to accept everything. Yeah. I think the next horizon is us helping shops focus on what they're great at. And a network of shops that are able to focus on what they're great at is the kind of next big productivity enhancement. And if we've solved the automation problem, we're uniquely positioned to solve that problem.
Yeah, I like it. I like it. I write things down that stick with me. And the one thing I'm glad you said was more productive. I am at Toolpath to make machinists much more productive. And it's not an easy trade. I came here because when I talked to Andy and Justin, the two founders, they both said they started with the agreement that we're going to respect the complexity of the problem. And I remember, I'm not exaggerating when I said I felt goosebumps when I think it was Andy was the first person to tell me that. And I was like, man, you know how many people, how many managers and different people have told me this shouldn't be that hard.
Here's the thing. And this is the thing that I think is going to be maybe an unpopular opinion, but automation is going to make it harder, not easier. To me, what automation does is it increases the productivity, but in increasing the productivity, it also increases the skills gap for said person that's running at the higher level productivity. The world will just consume more. And more people of it, like when I took this job, I was in Mexico building houses. This is not just an American greed thing of I want a bigger house. It's a lot of the world doesn't have access to basic necessities. And our machining is the mother of all manufacturing. Yeah. Our ability to produce more will allow more to be produced. So it's not like demand is going to drop. Demand will skyrocket, but in increasing productivity, you're then going to be now the machinist is responsible for 10 machines, thinking about quality process across 10 machines. Now the pilot is the navigator taking over in a heavy crosswind landing. It doesn't reduce the complexity of the trade. What it does is increase the productivity of the trade.
Yeah, for sure. I think
I go off on a rant on that, but it's it's a very fundamental thing for us.
I think fundamentally we need education to change. I think we need to change even at the shop level how we teach. I think for so long we've taught like basic skills, and you build up enough basic skills and you kind of step up like that. I think we need to be more mindfully teaching like just basic problem solving skills and, you know, inspection and, you know, just bigger thinking type
bigger
stuff.
Thinking in the same way, like when I took over to teach, when I was said I want to teach SolidWorks, it's like, I did like the first week of class, I did orthographic projection and help people understand like how a front, top, and side view translate into a 3D view. But you don't need to figure out all the details of the drafting board and all of the mechanics of how to make that work. That's been automated. The human now with parametric solid modeling, you're thinking more about the design process. And so as we automate the mundane things to think about the higher order skill. And to your point, the higher order skill is like, how do we build quality process? And maybe the machine takes longer to make the part, but it's higher reliability.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the machine likely will. We want the machine to spend more time working, so we have to do less, which feels like at odds. But for the most part, it seems like machinists have been chasing like cycle times. Like, we shouldn't be working with a machine. It should be working for us. How do we flip that around a bit?
Yeah, when labor is the highest expense in your building, and somebody's watching the machine make a part, it's fine to sprint through it and break a tool every once in a while. But when the machine is just should be on cruise control while you're doing, you know, other things.
When you think about the spotlight customers that are in peak productivity,
mm-hmm.
maybe it's just because CJ is my friend, but there's never a time where I can't call CJ and he's calmly and casually got time to talk to me for a couple hours.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, he's one guy running six machines. I don't know. By the time we're watching this,
he's a bunch of machines. Yeah, they're definitely like, making babies.
He's built such a good quality process that scales. And to me, he's the role model for our industry. He gets work that's a fit for him. He knows what he's good at. He's built quality process around that.
Yep.
He only does a certain set of things. Somebody else can do something else.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. So kind of starting to wrap up our conversation, Al. We could talk.
How many people made it this far?
Yeah. How many people made it this far? We do talk for hours and hours. So, let's head towards the close. I want to think more, about building Toolpath, building an industry. Let's talk about Toolpath real quick. Like, what's a core principle you really feel like you're not willing to compromise as we're growing Toolpath?
We leave the shops better than we shops that work with us better than we found them, and we leave the industry better than we found it, even if we crash and burn.
That seems like a good one. That's like just your shop floor borrow a tool kind of thing, right?
Simple little stuff, but the people that commit 90 days for $90, send them a box of $90 of stuff that's going to make their shop better. Like, I think we have to do it in everything we do. We were just having a meeting before this about how we're spending our marketing dollars. And it's like community, community, and community. Like, let's pour into the community. At least we've left the industry better than we found it. And oh, by the way, that's a snowball that can actually turn into an avalanche. So it's the best thing for us to do anyway.
Yeah.
But if we completely flop, and in the end, the machining community did better and it wasn't just going into a Google AdWords budget, then I feel good about that.
Yeah, I can say, so I have a probably a pretty unique perspective. As I often do, I think, but yeah, I started as an HSM Works customer, right? And I had used a handful of probably literally five or six other CAM tools. And HSM was the first CAM company that I felt like I was a part of whatever it was.
You were.
you guys made me feel like I was invested in
it. We weren't just making you feel though. Like I knew I wasn't a great machinist and the development team knew they knew nothing about machining. We just knew how to make software. Like we wouldn't have succeeded without you. Like that's, we weren't just making you feel that way.
Yeah. Well, you made me feel that way.
And, because it was true.
And, you know, so then I have that perspective. I have my perspective at Autodesk where I was the one of the champions for like, no, we need to make our customers feel like they're part of our future as we build Fusion. And it's been really fun, you know, building that same, you know, that same culture here. So with that, I am focused on the tools these days more than ever. How do you want Toolpath customers to feel when they're using Toolpath, but also when they're interacting with us?
I want customers to genuinely believe that our interests are aligned and that we genuinely want their businesses to grow and thrive. And I want to put ourselves in a position that is, it's not just saying it, it's meaning it. And I know I've got some flack for my thought around growing the business through machine connections. But to me, that's a way that I don't want our business to do better if we're not making you better. And the easiest way I can measure that is the number of spindles you have relative to the number of people you have. It's not a business model we've released yet, but I don't just want them to feel it. I want it to be the reality. I want us to succeed because we've made them more successful.
Yeah, that's interesting. I hope we're not oversharing. Like, I think some of that flack you've probably had from me.
Other people have told me too. Like, it's uncomfortable changing business models.
What I'll share is life is about timing, right? Yeah. And I actually agree with it as a business model. You know, in theory, we are oversharing, but our behind the scenes conversations are always like product right now. And I think we earn our way to kind of build into that business.
I think both of us probably have some PTSD from change that we went through in the last company we were a part of. So
yeah.
I've made some mistakes even at Toolpath trying to get ahead and over communicate where we're heading to avoid the knowing kind of where I want to take the company. But at the end of the day, we have to do the right thing. There has to be trust that we are going to do the right thing. And I refuse to be leading the company if we don't. But I probably, if you go back to some of my mistakes, probably get ahead of myself trying to make sure that I'm extra honest. And it's weird.
Yeah. That spurs on what just popped in my head, Al, was, man, there's a lot of like tech bro talk, that makes me almost want to puke in my mouth. But like customer at the center is what just kind of popped in my head. I mean, the truth behind it is everybody kind of wants that. I don't know how many people really, put that into action. And I think you do a really good job, you know, building a culture around that. I think the way we've hired for our customer facing team, the way we, you know, interact with our customers all stand testament to that. Now, my question, I guess that's a statement. I guess my question to that, I do not envy you. I'm not generally an envious person. I appreciate people, but I definitely don't envy you with the pressures that comes with being a CEO of a startup that, to be honest, burns. You know, we have very good, very qualified people. So there's a lot of pressures that come with feeding all those people. How do you keep the customer as the focus or as the center, as the tech talk would be, with all the pressures of a startup and a board? Like, you just came back from a board meeting, and talk however you want to that.
I'll start with the board. You surround yourself by people that are willing to tell you the things you need to hear, not the things you want to hear. A board is an interesting thing in the sense that I kind of hire the board, but the board kind of works for me too. So far, there's been only one board member that I've picked, and that's John Saunders. And John is somebody that has consistently told me directly, you need to do this, you don't need to do this, you can't do this, you shouldn't do this. But he's also said, Al, tell me how to jump and I'll just tell me how high. So like I trust him, but I also know that he'll stay true to his integrity and is true to his conviction for the industry and for the customer. And if I end up off course on that, I know that he will be a voice in those board meetings, which is why I tapped him on the shoulder. And then I'm going to kind of like speak to his, who knows, maybe I'll listen to this and it'll feel weird, but he'd not really done something before. So I connected him with Carl to kind of see like, how do you think this will go? And Carl had told us some like, the hardest thing you might have to do is one day you might have to fire Al. So it's like, it's hard for him too, right? He's, we both came into this being friends, but if stuff goes sideways and I fail to do my job, then, he might have to be part of the team that's telling me that. So selecting my bosses. So that's kind of the chance I get to do.
Yeah.
The biggest way I can make sure we stay customer focused is make sure I create a culture and select people on the board. And I don't have a huge ability to influence the board, but, that's one critical way that, I know I can keep myself honest by having his voice there, because he's proven to have integrity over the years and be consistent on that.
Yeah. I've been friends with John. I consider him a pretty good friend. If there's a person you can't tell them how to feel, John would be one of them. I think about, tying this back to you downplay being a machinist for a couple of years, but you've definitely been a user of machining tools for a long time. With that perspective, like how does that shape how you try to push, a company that's building tools for people to feed their families, basically?
Well, does it? I have a personal philosophy that I don't push rope. I'll only pull rope. So you can't push. You can only inspire, or it's a waste of energy to try and push. So to me, it's more about setting a culture that gets the right people in the right places and removes obstacles for the right people. And sometimes it's obstacles for themselves. Recent changes in product and moving you into product. And that was a hard one. Justin, the CTO, has become a good friend. And I told you, like, I bet my career on him. He was carrying the weight of Toolpath on his shoulders and doing some things that were not in his core strength, some things that he's great at, but we need him focused somewhere else. I think the only way I can do it is pave runway in front of the team, whether that's, and runway, that's the biggest obstacle I need to remove for the team. But make sure I'm getting the right people in the right places and remove the obstacles that are in their way to do their work. That's the one piece. And then inspire them to focus on the customer problem that's the most relevant. And so that's part of why we have you as the chief machinist, which you've got to kind of work through. Like, you're a great machinist, so you have I'm kind of maybe a bit of advice for you now. You have a different problem than I had. I always knew I wasn't the best machinist. So it was a lot easier for me to get feedback from other machinists. Mm-hmm. You are a great machinist. So how do we help make sure that the team's got an open mind to see the value in what other people have, while also having the strongest person you can have. And I make the same mistake. I've got like strong convictions on what's differentiating value and how to focus in on it. And I kind of started my story with the differentiating value of a ski trip, and then a big blind spot on how I communicated it, which you actually knew better and had said something. And I just missed it because I was so mission focused. Checks and balances of staying mission focused, but having people around you that can guide you when you miss.
That makes sense to me. Okay. I've got a handful of questions to kind of wrap up, but before we do that, I have two. One about just AI, right? We are an AI company. We have a really cool AI engine that helps us do what we do. How do we keep humans in the loop while we're leveraging this scary AI to help people run their shops? I know this is something that we've talked about, quite a bit, especially actually, I can't say I've said the word AI in a pretty damn long time. But definitely in the first 6 months, we were like, we need to involve the people. So the question, I rambled there, but the question is like, how do we keep humans in the loop as we're building, leveraging this AI tool to help them be more productive?
I'm going to roll my eyes a little bit at AI. When I think about AI, it's just the compute technology has got to the point where it can start to make decisions and more intelligent decisions based on a broader set of constraints. So it's, and so how we ensure that we're building a system with the right guardrails so that it can adapt for, it can adapt for the shop that's using it. Our system has got to have the foundational concepts that are right so that you can build your process around it. In many ways, it's like we're teaching a system instead of a person. I'm just coming up with an analogy on the fly, but my job was to set foundational skills so that person could go into the workforce and the workforce could guide them the way they wanted, but they had some good, strong foundational skills. To me, our job is to build an AI platform that's got foundational understanding of machining, but do it in a way that's malleable. So when a shop uses it, I use these tools in this way. A student that graduates from a good school should be able to get to work right away, but they should also be able to learn and adapt themselves. I learned way more in the shop I was working in than my apprenticeship, the training I did at college. Yeah. And if we do our job right, we'll build a system that has got good foundational skills, but the people that using it can adapt it to their process and the unique parts they're making. How I do that, I don't know.
Well, I think you do a good job of making, our customers real to the people that are building the tools. So kudos to you for that. Last kind of canned question before we just wrap up. But I often ask many people on here, if you were going to start a job shop tomorrow, and I decided to change that a little bit. So you have a couple, young men, your sons are young adults and almost a young adult. You have two young adults now.
One that's married but in nursing school. One that's applying for colleges and universities.
Last year, high school,
pursuing
right?
engineering.
Yeah,
and then two that are middle school and just started high school.
So if one of your sons said, "Hey, Dad, I think I want to start a job shop tomorrow," like, what would be front of your mind to kind of guide him in a direction? Like, what are a handful of the most important things you need to be focused on and not lose track of?
Build relationships with their customers, or relationships. And then specifically, I think the things that leaning into the fringes, the amount of demand the world has, you can make a solid living being the best at something small. That's something I realized when I was joining Autodesk. It's not going to be very hard for me to be the very best person understanding CAM software on Autodesk because nobody else does. And so finding, and this is like from our generation where they we'd hear in school, be all you can be, tended to lead people to the Peter principle and lead people to like become the, reach the peak of their incompetence, as opposed to saying, what is the thing I can be the very best at? So you want to find the thing you can be the very best at. If I was a job shop trying to say, what can I be the very best at? I think it would be, trying to do secure work, because that's very dependent on trusted, tight relationship, whether it's secure in the sense of aerospace work or secure in the sense of I'm building the prototype for this other company that's building their business and they need to trust me to make their prototype and it doesn't leak to the rest of the world.
Yeah.
I don't want this going off and having somebody else see my part. So I think secure work is important. And I think high tolerance work is important. I think there's more than enough startups and not startups. Sendcut Send is a good example of a company that will, I have all the confidence in the world. They will solve that. If I want it plus or minus five, it's going to be bang on, but wouldn't be such a bad thing to have a Kern to take that plus or minus five and get the high tolerance bits to, to on size. So yeah, I think it's secure work from the sense of like a tight relationship of something that matters or higher tolerance work, sub processes.
I like it. I like it. Yeah. So we're going to transition into the wrap up stuff. What are you most fired up about at Toolpath? It's a two part question. Cause it's what are you most fired up about in your personal time and at Toolpath? So you can answer them however you want.
I don't know how to answer it. The last year and a half of my life at Toolpath has been pretty emotionally exhausting, and that tends to cascade both on the work front and on the personal front.
I've been
taxing. I'd say my wife probably sees the worst of it. But that's also the thing I'm most fired up about the last few weeks. I think the things that have broken me down personally have brought us much closer together, and I'm pretty fired up about that.
Good for you.
But my level of stress has certainly had some low points. And I think I'd say the same for Toolpath, the level of stress of like the manic, like we're starting to get some traction. That just worked for 3 months and now we got to figure out something else. I'm pretty fired up about the process of 90 days, $90. I'm pumped about that because I believe that 90 days is a good time frame to adopt something new. Today, we're solving the clean up your basement problem. And what I mean by that is most shops don't have organized tool libraries, and we're just helping them see the value in organizing their tool libraries. And it's like, everybody's got a dirty basement and you just need somebody to stand next to you and say, let's get this sorted out. But I think there's 5 or 10 years of additional challenges as we get closer to automation of, well, the next thing is now we want to connect the machine in and close that loop. And the next thing is we want to help the next problem. So I'm pretty fired up that I believe we have a sales process that gives shops a pretty low friction way to evaluate whether or not we're a good fit and for us to evaluate whether or not they're a good fit for us. And so as our technology matures, we're simply going to be changing in that 90-day window what we're doing to adopt to help make sure that shops have. And it's not even that it takes 90 days to adopt it, it's that everybody's so constrained by time that I think we've got a process. I'm pretty fired up about the process that's respectful of the shop that says, even though you could get adopted in 2 weeks, you've got a business to run. Then we're going to run alongside you for this change for 90 days and get you adopted. And at the end of it, like you can just like, if you want to walk away and it's not a fit, that's totally fine. Because I don't have to claim churn until somebody makes it past 90 days. So it's not a bad thing for me and the board of saying I had churn. Track us on growth. And when you convert me after 90 days, then it's growth for us. So I'm pretty fired up that we have a process that I think is the right thing for for Toolpath to evaluate if the customer is a good one for us and allow us to spend our time on the ones that are committed as opposed to just a trial.
Yeah.
And I'm excited for the shop. So yeah, I think that process, that adoption process is the thing that's got me most excited about.
Cool. I also know you're fired up, speaking as a friend, that we have a really cool machinist event at Mammoth Mountain.
Yeah, I totally missed on that one. But.
And so please share what you, I give my version, but I think it's freaking awesome. I think it is one of those examples of Al thinking up big, crazy ideas. I think it's going to be something really special. I think of in the last 10 years at Autodesk and then last year and a half at Toolpath, some of those meaningful connections I've made in my life have been, you know, in the evening at IMTS or walking down the hall at some other trade show. So this feels very special to me. So tell me what it is, when, where, and the juice, you know, give me the good juice.
So it's,
we're going to start with, when?
Yeah. April 13th to 16th.
Okay. What's it called?
The Machining Summit on the Summit.
Okay. Where, if Bob or Sarah are listening, where do they go find more about this?
If you go to the Toolpath webpage, you can click events. If you Google search Machining Summit on the Summit, I think you'll find it.
Thank you for our Instagram.
We're gonna do a better job of getting it out there. It's on our social media and some other social medias.
Yeah. Okay. So it's the, not talking about myself, but it's a big one for me because, I should have died on, April 12th this year and, it starts April 13th. So it'll be my year of I'm still alive.
And it'll be 2 years since I started at Toolpath on the.
Oh, no kidding.
On the 15th.
Oh, that's an interesting one. What are you hoping people get out of it?
Connections. I'm a big fan of culture. I've been told all the time, like, it's just like you just create a culture for organic magic to happen. And inside the big company, people always tell me you can't do that. And now I get to. But I maybe I'm too gullible. I trust people quickly, but I genuinely think most people want to do the right thing. And in creating a space that allows them to be free to do that. I don't know. I mean, I selfishly, I know what I want to get from Toolpath. And so I'll be open about that afterwards. But I'm excited to see the connections that happen and what results of that. And so everything about the summit is just intentional mechanisms to facilitate collaboration in places you might not have before. Whether that's the 20 minutes on a chairlift where you get randomized going up, or the time that people spend on the rock crawlers with you, or then the group sessions, the small group sessions of 15 minutes to kind of be more open in a longer form. Like, once we've had enough of the fluorescent lights and trade shows, I'm not to say those aren't good, but yeah. I think just like this conversation's been almost 3 hours. But I just think the magic that can happen of 14 people that are like-minded sitting in a casual living room setting to have a conversation. I have no idea what that magic is going to be, but I know that there's going to be at least 10 conversations that are pretty magical and changing because of the caliber of the people that are coming. So I'm excited for that.
If I could jump in real quick. So there's a couple like big sessions or several big sessions that have what I think are some of the industry's most interesting people. Our industry's full of interesting people. So anybody listening, go check out the landing page. Scroll down to check out the different sessions. I think that's the jewel of the whole thing.
The panel conversation. So we'll start with our first panel conversation. But to me, and this is something I've found, I've learned a lot while sitting on panels explaining something. It's actually been clear to me in that conversation. But I think what you tend to end up finding, if you go to a session where there's one instructor, at the end of the session, 40 people line up to talk to the person that presented. What you'll end up noticing at the end of a panel conversation is there's a whole lot of people talking to each other.
Yeah.
So not only is it great people at the front that I know will inspire great dialogue, but a measure of success will be that there's not a line of people waiting to talk to people at the front. There's a whole lot of people that are talking as a result of the panel conversation. The panel conversations is the cornerstone of the event. And then the other bits are intentional times to put people together and stuck on a chairlift, racing each other on the RCs, stuck in a condo living room, that make that awkward moment inspired by dialogue that kind of like now unlocks it because you're in a smaller group setting. So yeah, you're right to say the panel is the thing that should be the catalyst of the conversation. And then the other events are intentional events that make it easier to have open conversation.
Yeah, it's no secret that I'm fond of the late Bill Selway, and it kind of pops up a memory. I'm going to try not to get teary-eyed, you know, as I share, but at one of the, they have a holiday open house type thing, and I think it was the last one that he was at. He walked up, put his arm around me as I was talking to Brian from B2 Machining, and he was like, "This is what it's all about, Tim. It's all about relationships." And I've spent decades, you know, investing in these events to get people together, show them where the future's going, and just help people make connections and build relationships. And this feels very, very aligned with that. So kudos for you as a CEO. I think you're the one that, if it belly flops, has the biggest pie in the face. So,
and this has been the hard thing with our internal team, to be like me planning this event and kind of keeping the rest of our team from it. But in many ways, you're exactly right. If it belly flops, I want to make sure that I flop. And if it's a success, I want to make sure our team is a part of it. So I've got my internal number. If we hit that number, then the whole team is coming. And if we don't hit that number, I'll stand alone and say I wasted company money on this.
Yeah.
Right now it's I was worried about the number of people registered. As of right now, I think it's about 62.
Awesome.
I was telling my wife, it's like, oh man, I don't know if this is going to win or not, because it's expensive, but still, yeah. Toolpath is losing a significant amount of money if it's below 120.
So
I'm stressing out. My wife's like, I'm a planner and I wouldn't have booked yet, so
yeah,
likelihood of it being a strong success is high, but I'm still stressed about it, because it's like, I just, like IMTS, I committed a good chunk of money in terms of like renting Canyon Lodge and committing to hotel blocks and all that. Yeah, hopefully I did a good job of protecting you as a team if it flops, and letting you all be a part of it if it's not.
Let's see. I've really enjoyed, I've had several messages on Instagram from some machinists that I respect to the moon when they registered. So anybody else, keep sharing that. It's been fun. Let's wrap it up with this one. So I have a habit of thinking about friends and colleagues and career, you know, industry people, in a simple summary, and maybe that's not fair, but, when I think of you, Al, I think of, you know, strong family man, man of crazy ideas, to kind of jump off of the mammoth, get together. And then also a man of pretty strong faith. Now feel free to share or not share however you want. But what I would like is some insight as to how those three things, if you disagree, do share. But what I would like to get your perspective on if you agree that those are pretty fundamentally like pretty center of who you are, how do you think that shapes decisions you make and just the character and who you are?
You're right.
Is it fair to start?
The shirt
work hard, trust God.
Work hard, trust God is the shirt my wife got me. You're right. How they shape who I am, I hope how they're shaping who I am is blurring those three things together. That's the thing I've struggled with the most.
Oh, interesting.
I end up uber focused on work and then neglecting my family, or I'm on vacation, uber focused on my family and then neglecting my work. I end up in settings around faith and segmenting that from work and thinking, well, I'll work so that I can then contribute in the church over here. And what's really been shaping me lately is understanding that all three of those are parts of me and not to segment them. I kind of talked to another podcast, but it's interesting. I just left one of the events that was faith-based, and some of the people shared their testimony. I'm like, why does my testimony not matter, is what I was thinking in my kind of heart. And then I end up at IMTS and shake a guy's hand, Nick, and he sees my faith-based bracelet and says, well, why don't you tell your story on our podcast? And I'm like, no, I separate work and faith. Those are two different things. So I think that's the thing that's been kind of shaping me lately is how do I just be me and not three different, three compartmentalized personas, which are all true, but I tend to be like, I'm this one right now, I'm this one right now, I'm this one right now. I don't know if that's a good answer, but that's at least the pressure I've been feeling, especially with a year and a half that is like the work portion of those three has been the most consuming.
Yeah. I think you've shared some really good stories of how you've, you know, come to some decisions. I personally have always appreciated just who you are, you know, when it's just the two of us. We speak pretty openly about just about everything. And so I appreciate you sharing all that, Al. It is coming up on 3 hours. Hopefully we still have a couple people more than our moms listening.
Mom and dad. I'm sure they have listened to
the world. Just my mom listens and tells my dad all the crap I talked about him. Okay, so if anybody's following you, where are they going to follow you at? Where are they going to connect with you? How about that? I appreciate how accessible you've always been with our machine community. So where does somebody connect with you if they wanted to connect?
You can email. It's easy. It's al@toolpath.com. I will say that I keep a very cluttered inbox, and if it makes it past the bottom of the Google page, it's not that I don't care. Just send me an email again.
That makes me feel better about my inbox. Thank you.
Yeah, I think God, I don't know. I can take a look right now, but probably 37,000 unread emails. Who knows how many it is. So you can email me, but that's probably going to fall quickly. I like to stay pretty active on Instagram, LinkedIn. I keep a good eye on.
I think LinkedIn and Instagram are good ones for anybody on those two. Same with me, One Ear Tim, on Instagram. And
the thing I'm trying to figure out is, like you said, I responded to you pretty quickly, and I tend to like, I don't like being the obstacle.
Yeah.
And so I tend to like try and respond quickly because I don't want to be the obstacle to progress.
Yeah.
But back to my earlier point, the thing I've got to figure out is, how do I also put my phone down when it's family time?
Yeah.
I'm struggling on that one. So
yeah.
If somebody listens to the podcast and has a good,
share with both of us, please.
Yeah. No, I will say that I shared that with the board that I've got. And I was pretty nervous because I was kind of thinking about signing up for a workshop for CEOs that kind of focus on this. Mm-hmm. Wasn't inexpensive, and I was nervous to ask the board, and they instantly said, yeah, do it. So I'm gonna try that. Strategic coach is what I'm gonna go to. But I only say that to say that I only picked one board member, but they've all been phenomenal in supporting me.
Good.
I guess I picked Justin and Andy because I accepted the job.
I like it. Well, I appreciate your time. I know you're busy. I'll talk to you as soon as whenever we need something. So
we'll probably talk for another hour after this recording is done because we are good friends.
But, that's right.
Hopefully this was interesting, and maybe I said something interesting. Maybe I said something wrong. Then hopefully somebody reaches out and tells me what was wrong so I can learn.
It's all good. All right, buddy. Cheers.
Cheers. Bye.